Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend, UFC 260, and we couldn't be more excited about it. Huge rematch for the heavyweight title. 40 pay-per-view events since these two guys last met. Stipe Miocic, of course, taking on the Predator, Francis Ngannou. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. And with me, as always, one half of the Allen Brothers. And I'd say one half of Fight Night Picks, but we've recently added to the team. We've got Matt Allen. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram, at Matt Allen FNP. All sorts of crazy stuff going on with Fight Night Picks. We have fighter interviews from our own John Hyun Ko at JHK MMA. We always used to say friend of the show. Now he's a part of the show. Interviews with Sasha Platnikov, Joe Selecki, Kyle Daukaus, more TBA. There's some great ones coming out later on this week. And as always, episodes of Early Stoppage coming out with myself and John Franklin. An awesome episode of State of the Divisions. Glad a lot of people have really kind of been receptive to that this week. And we couldn't be more excited, like I said, Matt, for this weekend's card with 260. Very unfortunate that our co-main event fell out between Brian Ortega, who is going to be challenging for the featherweight belt against Alexander Volkanovski. To me, that was the one that I had starred for this card. But overall, still a lot of great fights here.
Oh, I agree. But I also do agree in the fact that the co-main event was the fight I was probably the most excited for going into this weekend. A new matchup. You were kind of wondering, okay, we know how good Volkanovski's striking wrestling is. Ortega brings a new wrinkle to it. So that was going to be a fun fight. But you said a big event this weekend. This might be the biggest title fight in heavyweight history, just based on the size of both these guys. You have Francis Ngannou is fighting Stipe again for the second time. And I do love the narratives going into this fight, because you have Stipe, he beats Francis, loses to DC, he's able to recapture his belt. Stipe's the greatest fighter of all time. Francis, it's like he's had this massive journey to get back to the title shot. Everyone's down on him, people forget about him, they say he's shot for and he's gun-shy now. Goes out there and has one of the worst fights of all time, and then picks himself back up, and looks like one of the most dangerous men on the planet again, knocking everyone out who's been in the cage with him. And that's what's so fun, really, about a Francis Ngannou fight. Basically, it's how long his opponent survive. But we know that Stipe can take pretty much everything Francis can throw at him and give him even more. Such a great fight. And there's a lot of other great fights on this card, too. I know I'm really excited for the Bukowskis Olajechuk fight. I know I probably butchered both those last names, but a lot of great fights in this card, top to bottom.
So many great fights. So, Matt, let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, presented, as always, by Manscaped. And these ones this week were voted by you, the fan. And as always, Matt, our Fight of the Night screen presented by Manscaped. And I'll talk about my nuts later on in the show, as I always tend to do. But overall, we went with the fan vote this week. Over in the YouTube community tab, we're always active there. You can always vote on polls and you can find the latest stuff from the channel. But we threw it out there today, 6 hours ago. 730 votes so far. Full card video set to drop later on tonight. You know that already. Who's your pick for Fight of the Night? 28% went with... might be a surprise, but 49% Miocic Ngannou, Matt. How can we not talk about this? It is at the top of the card. And I mean, you're going to have to go to the prediction video itself to get the preview and all of the analysis. But just at a glance, like I said to open the show, I mean, we're 40 events away from UFC 220. Maybe I'll include some video highlights of my time at UFC 220. But you could have cut the tension with a knife in that arena that night. I can't imagine what it would be like in a smaller setting at the Apex for this one.
It's really weird because you have Stipe, who is the greatest heavyweight of all time, one of the greatest fighters of all time, but his last two fights haven't been in front of fans, and that seems really weird to me, honestly. And the fact that this fight isn't going to be in front of fans means that we're going to hear every single shot that both guys lands during this whole entire fight, and that's kind of terrifying, if I'm being honest, because when you can hear every shot that Francis Ngannou lands... you're going to leave the fight with a very uncomfortable feeling most of the time. And for Francis, we've seen the journey that he's had to go on. He looked terrible against Derek Lewis, picks himself back up against Blades, who's stylistically bad in that matchup, looks great against Velasquez, looks good against Jarzinho. He's just really shown the improvements that we were really hoping he would make after that first fight with Stipe. And what more can be said about Stipe? Like, he is the greatest heavyweight of all time. Phenomenal wrestler, phenomenal cardio. I'm so excited for this fight.
Strong style, stand up. And for Francis Ngannou, coming out of Extreme Couture, a little bit of work at the PI, very important, because we haven't seen him at MMA Factory in some time, and he's continued to win without Fernand Lopez, and there seems to be a huge rift between those guys. So we'll see how that develops as the years go on, but a great fight here, and we'll flip it on over to the other fan vote for Fight of the Night. So I opened up the Fight of the Night screen saying that 28% of fans went with maybe an unorthodox pick, maybe a fan favorite type of pick. Let's go through them. I threw down a Zaitsar Burial, 7%. I threw down Malarkey Worthy, 12%. But 28% went with Thomas Almeida and Sean O'Malley. And Matt, I'd say it's a crossroad fight, but that's wrong. I mean, you look at a guy in Thomas Almeida that had legit title aspirations when he came into the UFC. He was an absolute buzzsaw, but he's 1-4 in his last five. And if you look at it in the fight against Jonathan Martinez, his last time out, Martinez said as much. Listen, Thomas Almeida was actually one of my idols to get into fighting, and he thought that Almeida was going to be champ at some point. And that's not crazy. A lot of fight fans thought that. And they still feel that way. And I know Sean O'Malley still feels that way about himself. I mean, he entered the chat there on one of our live streams. I believe it was a question mark kicks. It might have been a fight companion. And O'Malley, the legit O'Malley, came in and put 12-0 and hopped out of the chat. See you later. Now, he's not 12-0. And he did get beat pretty soundly by Chito Marlon Vera. But this fight here signifies a huge opportunity for both of these fighters.
It's a really fun fight. Now, I agree with almost everything you've said, but I do have to say this. Thomas Almeida is not going to be a UFC champ. It's too far for him. But he's always going to give you a fun fight, and that's why I think a lot of people did vote for this to be their fight of the night, because Sean O'Malley, he's got the kind of cult following, if you will, at this point. He's got very poor leg health, we know that, but he is a very fun fighter to watch, no matter what. A really fun style, a really good striker, too, and an accurate one at that. And for Almeida, he was the guy who fought Cody Garbrandt before anyone knew who Cody Garbrandt was. And he's kind of the stepping stone that Garbrandt used to eventually get the bantamweight title shot. That's how highly Thomas Almeida was held in regard of the UFC. Really, the 135 title picture. We didn't see him at 135 in his last fight. So I do think this will be interesting, him coming back down to his natural weight class. I couldn't be more excited for this fight.
Should be a great fight. Really, just a great night of fights.
Oh, yeah.
It should be a great card, and listen, as the week goes along, listen, Anthony Burchak was supposed to take on Johnny Eduardo a week ago. Eduardo had some visa issues. Iridium Sports put out a tweet, and they were on Instagram as well today saying that, hey, Burchak has a fight along with a couple of our other clients, so we'll see where Burchak lands. Does he get the Eduardo booking? There's been some rumblings that he might end up fighting Omar Morales. Sherdog has that listed, but nobody can confirm. So we're kind of in a weird spot. We actually waited an extra day to film the videos, and we're no clearer than we were last night, so really, we're just behind the eight ball. But as things are added throughout the week, make sure you keep it tuned in and locked in with Fight Night Picks. We'll have extended coverage of those fights as they come together. And listen, if you're a Fight Night Picks fan, I get it. Gregor Gillespie's not on this card, so we're not reeling in the deals. But at the shop, fightnightpicks.com, you can check out some of the great merch over there. We're having a sale right now. Make sure you use the promo code FNP25. From now until Saturday, you can save 25% off your order. We get the awesome Under Armour shirts with the original logo. We get the shirt I have on right now. We have the MLG-type jerseys. Listen, these are not selling like hotcakes, but they're like the syrup that you put on the hotcakes. This is great stuff. We also have, just in time for spring training, the Fight Night Picks jerseys as well. So make sure you head on over to the website, fightnightpicks.com, for more great stuff. There's interviews, there's write-ups, there's betting guides, there's all sorts of great stuff on the site. And as always, you can find these episodes as podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. So Matt, love the card. Really looking forward to breaking this one down. And as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Sometimes people give me grief when I start these videos and I say, really looking forward to or really excited about, but this is one of those fights that I am actually really looking forward to. We have Abu Zaitsar taking on, listen, Gatineau, Quebec, Canada's Marc-André Barriault. And Matt, for Barriault, it's weird, right? I mean, his last fight, he took on Oscar Piotta, and he absolutely beat the wheels off of Piotta. And listen, you got to give a little bit of backstory on that, because for Oscar Piotta, he came into the UFC, he was a Cage Warriors champion. The sky was the limit for Oscar Piotta, and that guy absolutely burned out. Like, he was gone in just a minute.
He flew too close to the sun, some might say.
Everybody that fought Oscar Piotta, oh, you got to worry about his grappling. And he's a decent striker, but Marc-André Barriault just absolutely, like, listen, a few guys that already ruined the hype, but Barriault really just stamped it. And I went full English on his name there. But for Barriault, I mean, what do we know out of him? It's pressure, pressure, and more pressure. And we talk about that in a lot of these fights. Like, you know, a guy that's fighting is like an offensive lineman. You just got to completely just obliterate your opponent. But for Power Bearer, that's exactly what he does. He always puts a pace on his opponent. He's trying to grind you up against the cage, getting that head placement, working the takedowns, trying to throw you. If you want a perfect example of a good Batty-O fight, he was a former TKO middleweight and light heavyweight champ. And again, the fight that you want to see is a fight against Fredericton, New Brunswick's own Adam Hunter. And I'm not talking about, listen, the comedian here. I'm talking about the man, the myth, the legend that was supposed to be in the UFC at one point, and he had some USADA issues, just like both of these guys. For Batty-O, he goes into that fight. It's an absolute slobber knocker for all of, well, around, and he just completely beats the wheels off Adam Hunter. So he comes into the UFC, loses to Andrew Sanchez. It's going to happen. Loses to Christoph Jocko. Close enough fight. It was a split decision loss.
One of the worst fights of all time, I have to say.
Jocko beats him, and then he goes out there and fights Jun Young Park, and when you fight the Iron Turtle, sometimes you're going to lose. So for Batty-O, three-fight losing streak, obliterates Piotta, and then he has a positive USADA test, and it's for Osterin. It was back in the summer. Then it was retroactive, and things moved around. I think it was, what, December when it was announced. And for Batty-O, he was upfront and honest about it. Listen, it was a tainted supplement, this and that. And that seems to be the consensus. So he had a long layoff. His last fight was back in June of 2020. And we get to see him back. For Abu Zaitar, yikes. There's been a lot of issues. And it's not just issues with the law. It's not just a hard time getting a visa, which he got for this one. And listen, you want to read about that one. Bloody Elbows got you covered. But for Abu Zaitar, he also had a lengthy USADA suspension. And for him, I got to get it right. It was, it was a suspension for tamoxifen. It was prescribed by a doctor, 7 month suspension retroactive to August 25th when it was announced. So February 1st, 2021, they put it out there. The weirdest thing about it, this is all as his brother Otman Zaitar is trying to get the bag. And not like, hey, let's go get the bag. It's like, hey, let's get the bag of potatoes. But they weren't potatoes.
They weren't.
So those crazy Zaitar brothers, they've done some wild and wonky things in their life. And I'm honestly, you know, I tried to make light of it. You shouldn't make light of it. Like, these guys have done some sketchy stuff. All that to say, when they fight, both brothers are exciting. For Abu Zaitar, doesn't necessarily fight like Otman, though, because we see a lot of pressure kicks. We see a lot of volume out of him, too. The one thing that I like out of a Zaitar, he blitzes forward. It's just he's not 100% accurate. He usually uses it to set up a big power shot at the end. But when he goes in there and charges, a lot of them are going to hit the forearms of his opponents when they shell up. But he usually ends it. He'll rip to the body, which I love to see. The nice left hook to the body. There's nothing that warms my heart more than that. Abu Zaitar, perfect fighter that really tries to pick away at the body so he can get at the head as the fight goes on. I actually love this fight stylistically. This should be an awesome one.
I am really excited for this fight. And for Marc-André Berrio, he has not had a very good run in the UFC. Let's just call it what it is. He was 0-3. And I know we like to talk, oh, this guy lost three fights and then the UFC gave them their papers. Normally they fight like two guys in the top 15. Then they'll fight someone who's unranked and then they might get cut. Berrio never even fought someone who was ranked. And it's a little concerning for me because I know how good he looked in that Piotta fight. And we were both like, wow, he might have finally made his turn. Like, this might be the fighter that we were once promised coming out of TKO. But it's not like he's the first guy to beat Oscar Piotta, and it's not even like he's the first guy to finish him impressively. We've seen that time and time again, and for...
Gerald Meerschaert sure did it.
Exactly. That tells you all you need to know. Now, I will tell you this, just because his name popped up on the screen. I was very excited when Abu Zaitar was supposed to fight Sayer Bahadurizadeh, because I'm a big Bahadurizadeh fan. He just throws a lot of power and leaves his head very exposed. Always a fun fight for that man. I have the number here. Marc-André Berrio had 197 picograms of Ostrin in his body. So if John Jones watches our videos, maybe he can tell us how many pinches of salt that is in a swimming pool. But it was a very small number, though, and it was from a tainted supplement, and he was cleared of all wrongdoing. So it's not like he has a real USADA suspension coming into this fight. I just am worried from the fighter that we've seen throughout his UFC debut, because I've got a couple numbers here. I did a little digging, and if you get rid of the Oscar Piotta fight and just look at his striking differential through the rest of his UFC career, he actually has a negative striking differential, and it's almost up to one strike a minute for how negative he is. And I know when you look at that Piotta fight, he does look really good, but I bring up how bad the Jocko fight was because I think it's a good example of what you brought up. Marc-André Berrio does move forward, and he does all those things that we kind of know his fighting style to be good with. A lot of forward pressure. He does try to pressure with the hands, go for a few takedowns, but when he fights even a decent striker, He can get out-volumed, and Kais can cut angles on him. He's not good at cutting the cage off. He will just kind of follow his opponent around in a circle. So if you are someone who has really good footwork, and again, it's not like a lot of guys in this division have the footwork of a Christoph Schrocco. He's a guy who has been ranked before. He's one of those borderline kind of top 20 to 15 guys on really any given day. But he was really able to use his movement to frustrate Barrios as that fight went on. And for Abu Azaitar, I don't think he's going to go into this fight fighting like Schrocco. I think he can throw some of the same techniques that Schrocco can. He's not going to go out there throwing like 9 spinning back kicks in a row, but he will switch it up with his kicks, and I think that's important, because for Barrios, who does carry his hands a little high, and you had mentioned it, brings this up, those body attacks are going to be there all day long. And for Barrios, I kind of compare him to an Ian Heinisch, where he doesn't really fight at this great pace and then he gets tired. He fights at a pace that's like a 4 out of 10 for the whole entire fight. He's not going to fall off any cliff, but it's not like he starts this fight with a full gas tank and he's going to go in there. He just kind of stays the same, and that does worry me. If he was a guy who could come in, have a big storm early, he might be able to get a Zaitar out of there. But I do think as this fight goes on, it just keeps on favoring a Zaitar. He has the body attacks. I think he's a more tactical striker on the feet. And you brought up with his combination, something Dan Hardy talks about a lot, that he had trained, he was just doing Muay Thai, where it's, you want to throw a combination, but you always want to change which punch in the combination is the power shot. And for Abu Azaitar, he's really good at doing that, and he can do it with his hands and his kicks. And like you had mentioned, he'll throw techniques just to throw sometimes, where they do look like they're landing on the arms, but I honestly don't think he's throwing those with full power. I do think he's a smart enough of a striker where he'll throw just to get you to cover up and open up some holes for him, and then he can expose some of your weaknesses. So I know Marc-Andre Barrios is a bit of a favorite, and I know you'll talk about the odds in a bit. I'm really surprised by that, honestly.
I went back, and again, you watch all these Abu Azaitar fights, and you have to mention it. I mean, his last fight was back in July of 2018. He's been on the shelf for a long time. So, Abu Azaitar could be absolutely spent, or he could have somehow learned later on in his career, which is really weird, because he's coming into this one. He's 35 already. He's no spring chicken. But you look at some of the wins that he has on his record. I mean, Piotr Struss was a drawback with KSW. Struss, a really good fighter that maybe you haven't heard of, but he's been around the block for a long time. Also had a knockout win over Jack Marishman back in 2014, which again, you might not like the Welsh paratrooper, but he was around in the UFC for quite some time while still being a paratrooper and getting in trouble for still fighting. But if you look at his UFC debut, he took on Vitor Miranda. What's Vitor Miranda good at?
Being old.
Technically, everything. He was what? He was good in savate. He was good in Muay Thai. He was good in jiu-jitsu. Like, Vitor Miranda, the best fighter that never was. But Miranda was old in that fight.
He was
39 in that fight? So Miranda kind of slowed down a little bit. The one thing that I did like out of Azaitar in that fight that I would like against a guy like Barrios, if Barrios pressures and he gets Azaitar down, Azaitar did against Vitor Miranda what Derek Lewis does in every fight. I'm just getting the F up and I'm using all my strength. Azaitar is not a big guy for the weight class. I mean, he's only what, 5'8"? Like, he's a short guy for this division, but he will just power himself back up. So if he has any of that explosiveness left in his body, I think he should be able to use it to his advantage.
No, I agree. And another just kind of short segment from that Miranda fight, he does jump for an armbar on Miranda, and it is really tight. I'm not saying he's going to go out there and submit Marc-Andre Barrios, but I do think that that is a facet of a Zaitar's game that doesn't get talked about enough. He is really good on the ground, and he can submit you in a plethora of different ways. And Miranda, yeah, he is kind of good at everything, but he is mainly known for his wrestling and jiu-jitsu. And for you to go out there and not... I understand he got taken down in that fight a few times, but for a Zaitar, like you mentioned, he's either getting back up to his feet or he's just going to out-scramble you and end up on top anyway. So I really do like a Zaitar in this fight.
So if we look at the odds, and this is always fun, Abu Zaitar open minus 130. 35 favorite or thereabouts. He's now plus 101. For Barrios, open a plus 135. He's now minus 124. Money's coming in on Barrios. 1,125 total votes on Tapology. 85% Azaitar, 71% by decision. I had Azaitar before I even looked at the Tapology picks, and I'm so surprised that the odds are skewed to Canada's way. And for Germany and Morocco, the fans have Azaitar.
Unless Yanni the Greek knows something I don't, and he put a bunch of money on Marc-Andre Barrios, I do like Azaitar in this fight. I just think he does everything a little bit better. I don't think cardio is going to be an issue for him. I think he's the better striker. It might be, but it's not like Barrios is some guy who can go out there and he's some cardio king that can really put it on you. If he is able to get some of those clinch positions, he can tire you out. But if it is a back-and-forth fight, I do think Azaitar has equal cardio to Barrios, so I think this will be a very fun fight, but I do think Abu Azaitar is going to win.
Tamoxifen versus Osterin. We'll see who wins out. We're both going with Abu Azaitar to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. Heavyweight title fight at the top. You have Stipe Miocic taking on Francis Ngannou. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. flyweight never die, which is something we say a lot with Fight Night picks, but not about the women's flyweight division. We say it about the men's division, but in the women's division, it is flourishing, and I could not be more excited about this fight. We have Jillian Robertson representing Canada at the highest level, taking on Miranda Maverick. Boo, she's from the States, we're Canadian. No, I'm just kidding. This should be such a good fight, and we already predicted it. We already did the entire preview just a few weeks ago, so we're going to throw it back to that. We're going to update the odds, and maybe we've had some second thoughts. Maybe we're flipping our picks, so keep it locked in, and we'll get right over to it. On free TV, you have Miranda Maverick taking on the Canadian Jillian Robertson. Matt, I'm Canadian. You're Canadian. I'm a Canadian hockey fan. Today I was feeling the Seattle it's hockey team. 2021. Who can't wait? But when I look at this fight, there's a lot of parallels between the co-main event and this one in terms of the fact that we have some really high-level prospects really looking to break through in this division. For Jillian Robertson, time and time again, she's had a chance. When she's come up against either really powerful strikers or really good grapplers, she kind of struggles. But if you look at the wins, she has a lot of really good finish wins to her name. And for Miranda Maverick, her UFC debut taking on Liana Jojua, you go back and you watch that fight and you can definitely tell there's power on the hands. If you look at the fact that her takedown defense throughout her young career has been somewhat porous, she's really been able to shore up a lot of those issues. And again, the heavy-handedness, the fact that she continues to start incorporating a leg kick in with her combination. She's only 23 years old, almost 24. For Robertson, 25, almost 26. Really high-level prospects
here. Oh, without a doubt. And I really like what you mentioned about Miranda Maverick. Yes, her takedown defense isn't great, but for a fighter who is only 23 years of age, and here's the thing, she had one of the more impressive UFC debuts of last year. I feel very comfortable saying that. Her performance against Jojua was as one-sided as it gets.
Well, the thing is, too, about that fight, if you look at the finish, I know it was very controversial. The cut man, as soon as he went in there between the first and second round, because if you look at her record, it was a TKO victory due to doctor stoppage at the end of the first round. The cut man goes and takes the cotton swab and puts it on Jojua's nose, and it immediately turns red. And
it's
then
like wide open.
The cut man kind of gives a look to the doctor like, hey, I'm not going to be able to close this one up. Now, I know a lot of people were upset. They said if that was a men's fight, it probably would have gone on. And to an extent, I would agree with that. They didn't even start to mess around with the Vaseline. It was just leaking blood. That was it. The corner wasn't overly surprised. Liana Jojua was surprised. But overall, Maverick put on a really good performance. Really high output. She did eat a lot of shots, though, in that fight. And that was the thing. Liana Jojua just kept going forward. Left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand. She just kept pumping them out there. And they were landing, and there was a little bit of power behind them, too.
But there wasn't that much power landed behind them. And this is my problem with kind of the Jojua striking, and it's the same thing. It's very Cindy Danbois-esque. If you just throw enough volume, you are going to land shots. The good thing for Miranda Maverick, and what I really like, especially out of this weight class, is she doesn't waste technique. She's not someone who will go out there and just try to out-volume her opponent. She throws with bad intentions. And for Jillian Robertson, you had mentioned it, and I kind of snickered. She struggles against really good grapplers, and she struggles against really good strikers. There's not a big window there for fighters who you're going to do all that well against. And listen, I'm a Robertson fan. I can't deny. After she had beat Molly McCann, in the way that she beat Molly McCann, I was on that hype train. If you go out there, and you not only submit, but you just completely strangle that woman unconscious, I was like, wow, Robertson
really... What do you think of Laura Procopio now?
She's also very good. I wouldn't really put her on the same level, but I think she's probably better than Robertson. Anyways, it's not here nor there. Robertson, just from her ground game, I thought, wow, if she can continue to improve at this rate, really get her striking up to the level of her grappling, we've got a real contender on our hands. But, and what I said for Maverick, she is a really young age. We are going to see more improvements from her. Robertson just seems to be more of the same fighter every time we do see her out there. It's not like we're seeing a fighter who was primarily a grappler, and now they're getting better in their striking, like Gilbert Burns, for instance, in the main event, where he was just grappling, oh, I'm just going to go for takedowns, trying to submit you, and now I have a good striking game. Robertson just kind of throws the same techniques on the feet. She only really boxes, doesn't throw a lot of kicks, and she does leave herself open to get hit. So although Robertson, I'm sure, listen, her striking has gotten better, it's just she's not adding new techniques. She's just doing the same thing more and more. Against Miranda Maverick, you are going to land some of those strikes. I just doubt that she's going to be able to land anything of substance against Maverick.
And Matt, you bring this up, and it's kind of an odd point to bring up, because if you look at Jillian Robertson, she was at ATT for the longest time. I know if you go over to her Instagram, she's been training with Hannah Goldie for a long time. The last picture they have together, Fusion XL. She's really been mixing it up. I know in her last fight against Tyler Santos, I had her gym listed as it was Gambler wrestlers, BJJ, and MMA. Now it's the gym with Dean Thomas, so it's kind of mixed up. But the point of all that is, she was at American Top Team, and then she went to train exclusively with Dean Thomas. And if you want to see a sad but incredibly funny clip, go over to my Twitter. I just put this one out there doing the research for this fight. Jillian Robertson's fighting Macy Barber. I liken this fight to that one. If you look at Maverick and you look at Barber, there's differences for sure, but you can kind of talk on the similarities. Jillian Robertson, right from Jump Street, goes lazy single, and she just puts everything in, and then she comes back up. And you see, if you see a lot of people feigning level change, usually it's a subtle or quick movement, and then they're back up and they're starting to strike again. Jillian goes all the way down, all the way back up. Barber doesn't really do a whole lot with it, but as the round goes on, Barber just continues to pressure, backs up Robertson. Then they cut to Dean Thomas in the corner, and he sits there, doesn't move his mouth, and he doesn't barely even move his arms. As Jillian Robertson gets absolutely fired on to the point where it ends by TKO, and it was the most awkward thing I think I've seen on live television.
It just wasn't a good look.
It wasn't a great look. So you look at Jillian Robertson, you think maybe she's added some wrinkles into her game. If you go over to her Instagram right now, she has a post from a couple of weeks ago that says, "She's not outworking me, guaranteed." I mean, I don't know what that picture says about getting outworked, but it's good, I guess. I mean, you know, hey, you love to see Canadians make an impact, whether on social media or in the fight game. Now, Matt, let's talk about Miranda Maverick. So we had that win in her last time out against Leona Jojua. Before that, a decision win over Pearl Gonzalez, UFC vet. And before that, she won the Invicta Phoenix Series 2, which is pretty cool. Now, I know the commentary talked about it a little bit in her last fight, and they said, oh, well, those wins should have been counted as real wins. Pump the brakes, guys. One-round fights should not count on your record.
They should.
But they're all good signs, and that's the thing. Miranda Maverick fought pretty good competition at the start, even in the fights that she lost. She's continued to take on a tougher level of opponent, and this is what almost surprised me. So I had a look over at the odds. Average on best fight odds, Robertson opened a plus 190 underdog. She's now at a plus 123. One of the bigger movers and shakers so far, and it's early, with Miranda Maverick open at minus 225. She's now at a minus 150 over on Tapology. 592 total votes, 67% Maverick, 73% have her to win by decision. The other thing that I wanted to talk about in this fight is the fact that with Miranda Maverick, they talk about her as a Muay Thai fighter, but her striking wasn't all that polished at the start. It's continued to improve. They talk about her as a grappler. She's a Muay Thai fighter and a grappler. She's left some things to be desired with her grappling, but she's continued to improve. And she's one of those fighters that if she's going to work for a takedown of her own, it's going to be on brute strength alone. We've seen that work for some fighters. You see it work against a lot of fighters because you expend a lot of energy. In Jillian Robertson, she had a hard time against a fighter that fights like that in Tyler Santos her last time out. Flat out, she got dominated in that fight. I mean, I went back, I looked at the numbers for the decision. 230-26s, 129-28. I think the judge that scored at 29-28 was asleep.
I think so.
Because Tyler Santos dominated that fight. In terms of jiu-jitsu rankings, in terms of the belt system, Tyler Santos is what? I want to say a brown belt, maybe a purple belt, Jillian Robertson an accredited black belt, but the belt system didn't matter in that one. Tyler Santos was going for takedowns, going for her own submissions, and having a lot of success. So for Jillian Robertson, she really needs a win here in this fight.
Yeah, no, Jillian Robertson just needs the takedown in this fight. That's really her key to victory. If you go back and look at that Macy Barber fight, it's weird because normally when fighters use head movement, it's to get out of the way of punches. And I don't mean this as a joke, but it's kind of the truth. Jillian Robertson moved her head into every punch of Macy Barber's.
It was also a pretty weak TKO call. Like, getting hit a lot. I think accumulation of damage was the reason why the referee stopped it, but it was somewhat weak.
She was out on her feet. Let's be honest. She got hit with 1,000 power shots and wasn't offering any defense. And that's really the problem with Robertson. If you do pressure her, she doesn't have a great reaction to it. Her only real choice, if you do get her up against the cages, I'm going to have to panic shoot on you eventually. Because I can't really... She doesn't have great lateral movement left to right, so she's going to have to go forward at a certain point. And if Miranda Maverick is starting to land her combinations, especially up top to the head, it's going to force Jillian Robertson to shoot for a takedown. And from what I've seen of Robertson, I thought she was a much better wrestler, especially coming into the UFC off the Ultimate Fighter. I knew how good her jiu-jitsu was, but it was really her wrestling that I find is a little underwhelming. And you go back and you look, her wrestling in MMA is not great. She really struggles with getting the takedown herself. And even when you look at the success that she's had on the mat, it's her opponent taking her down, and sometimes she can scramble and get on top. But a lot of the time, she'll fish for a submission. And if you go back to that Santos fight, she went for about 15 arm bars against Santos, did not get a single one of them, and just kept on getting dominated on the ground. So for me, this is a very cut and dry, easy win from Miranda Maverick. I haven't seen what I need from Jillian Robertson, just from a defensive point of view of how she's going to beat Maverick. Because if Maverick is able to get her leg kicks going, if she is able to get her combos going, I just don't know if Robertson has the power to get really the respect back from Maverick or the wrestling game to really, really grind down on Maverick. So I like Maverick in this fight.
And I mean, for Jillian Robertson, the fight against Tyler Santos just a month and a half ago, for Miranda Maverick when she picked up her UFC debut win little over 3 months ago, that one was over on Fight Island. The other thing I want to say about Jillian Robertson, so she comes in off the Ultimate Fighter season 26. She lost in the season. She got a win in the finale. So far, since then, 6-3 total record, 5 of those 6 wins by finish. And if you look at her losses, 2 of the 3 of them are by first round finish, and then she has that decision loss to Tyler Santos. So it's pretty, you know, it's either kill or be killed for Jillian Robertson.
It goes bad.
It does go bad. And for me, the biggest statement win for Jillian Robertson was against a fighter that fights with a lot of, I guess, pressure, and they use a lot of their body weight because they don't weigh in properly, and then they pop with USADA. The Sarah Frotto win, for me, is the biggest one for Jillian Robertson. It was like, wow, that was impressive, but that was quite a while ago. I mean, if I have to go back, that was a year and a half ago, and then since then, finished by Barber, you beat Courtney Casey by submission, you beat Pauliano Battaglio, and then you lose to Tyler Santos. So it is a tricky one. I like Miranda Maverick in this one. Again, her hands have been progressing. She throws a lot of power and decent power with the volume. You love to see it. As long as the takedown defense is there, I think Maverick should be able to get the win, and really high ceiling. I mean, either women, if they're able to get a win here, either one of these women have, again, an opportunity to really move up this division. Again, as far as second thoughts are concerned here, listen, I'm not really changing the way that I framed it, but what are you thinking on this one?
So again, I had said that I'm a massive Alan Joban fan in the last video, and Bojan Veličković. Jillian Robertson's also a big favorite of mine, but here's the problem. Also, I feel like I need to start this whole thing with this. I swear MMA was big in Canada at one point, and there was a lot of really good Canadian MMA fighters. I understand in recent memory, you might not remember a lot of great Canadian performances. Take out Charles Jourdain, but it hasn't been great for the MMA, for the Canadian MMA scene, I should say. I like Miranda Maverick in this fight, too. I really do. I think she has enough takedown defense to kind of to expose some of the holes that Jillian Robertson has in her striking. And I say holes, it's terrible, her striking. It's just not very good. She's very hesitant on the feet, and she refuses to throw her hands when she's in distance. A lot of her striking is just to get into the clinch to go for the takedown. And for Miranda Maverick, when you fought the women who she's fought on her way to the UFC, that we make fun of Deanne Bennett because she kind of licked the camera that one time, but that's a good win to have outside the UFC. Beating fighters like her, like Pearl Gonzalez, yes, they might not be in the UFC, but they're definitely what I would consider top-tier flyweights, especially just globally. So I like Miranda Maverick a lot. I think she's faced the higher level of competition, and I think she's been much more impressive too.
Matt, I'm going to give you a comp on this fight. And listen, you can draw comparisons and parallels to it if you want, but if you go back and watch Leslie Smith when she fought Amanda Lemos, I remember watching that not that long ago. I see this fight going exactly like that. And if you want the Jillian Robertson comp, I mean, she's had fights like that in the past where she's getting finished up against the cage.
Macy Barber.
Absolutely pummeled against Macy Barber. So for me, I really do like Maverick. Again, her striking's good, her power's good. If her takedown defense is halfway competent, if she doesn't get caught off her back, then she should be able to get the win, and I do see her getting the win here. So Matt, we're going to fear the Maverick, and I will never boo her again. I can promise you that. We have a great card coming up, and a great main card as well. Lots of fight of the night caliber fights. You got O'Malley taking on Almeida in the main event. We have, of course, Stipe Miocic looking to defend his belt against Francis Ngannou for the second time. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. We're making this video for Jimmy Crute and Ricardo Nasiglia. And I say that with a lot of conviction because we have a great fight at light heavyweight. The Baltic Gladiator, Modestas Bukauskas, representing Lithuania by way of Great Britain, taking on Poland's Michael Olszewczuk. And you know that Olszewczuk was a big fan of "We're on each other's teams." Whatever happened to Lord? It's a weird nickname. And if you want to see something really weird, I tweeted this out today. Go over to Olszewczuk's Wikipedia page. What a freaky picture that somebody put as his thumbnail. But we have a fight between two primary strikers. And for Modestus Bukauskas, former European K1 champ, he has a classic kickboxer in MMA type stance, but he's got a little bit of a wider base. And listen, the big knock against Bukauskas coming into the UFC was the fact that his takedown defense isn't all that great. We saw that in his debut against Andreas Mikhailidis, who has a big fight book coming up soon. And in that one, listen, they went tit for tat in the first round. Mikhailidis goes for takedown at the end of the first round, and then Bukauskas goes full Travis Brown. We're starting to throw those elbows. Did they land in the back of the head? I don't know, but if you're Mikhailidis, if you're going to lay back, don't lay back into an open cage door and fall out a little bit.
Not a good look.
Because that's how you lose a fight, and the referee's just going to say no dice. So we had that in Bukauskas' debut. He gets the win. He wins by TKO. Everybody's happy if you're in the corner of Bukauskas. Then he fights Jimmy Crute. And Jimmy Crute does what Jimmy Crute does. He doesn't take him down. He just spams right hands. And you could see it from the start. There was a huge lapse in defense from Bukauskas where Crute's overhand right started to land. And he just continued to go for it. And he landed with great effect in that fight. For Olszewczuk, he comes in looking like a wrecking ball. He beats Khalil Roundtree, has some USADA issues. Then he wins two more. He fights Jean Volante and goes all the way to the body. And listen, we've seen it from Jean Volante at 205 and 265. You're going to beat him? Hit him to the body.
That was a violent punch, though.
The cheeseburgers don't help. And then he fights Gedshimerad Antigulov. And if you want to see a sloppy 45 seconds of MMA, it's that fight. Because Olszewczuk just kind of runs around. He kind of lands some uppercuts and he gets Gedshimerad hurt. They end up on the ground. They get back up. It's a crazy sequence. The things you can tell, listen, Olszewczuk knows which punch to throw. I mean, and that sounds really stupid, but he knows exactly, hey, I've got this guy hurt, and even though his hands are down, I can land through the guard and hit an uppercut. He knows exactly when to run away, which you don't often see. I mean, you say, well, listen, Overeem knew when to do it, and JDS didn't know how to, but Olszewczuk knows how to do it. So he wins those two by finish. He gets Von Prude, and then he fights Jimmy Crute. Matt, Jimmy Crute landed takedown after takedown. I wrote the numbers down. It was 8 out of 11 takedowns in that fight, 8 out of 10. It was insane because it was kind of funny. You'd see one, and you'd think, well, was that a takedown? Are they scoring that one? And then all of a sudden, it was 5 out of 5 have already landed. And he just continued to take him down. He got him in one of those Kimuras where I thought, this guy's shoulder's going to pop out of his socket. It didn't, maybe, but you lose to Crute. So both of these guys have lost to Crute. But when I opened the video, I said a nod to Nasiglia. Bukauskas, KSW. Bukauskas is the champion from Cage Warriors. He beat Nasiglia to punch his ticket into the UFC. For Olszewczuk, he also beat Nasiglia. It was with fight exclusive night to punch his ticket into the UFC. So thanks, Ricardo Nasiglia, for both of these guys. They made it to the UFC off of your name. But ultimately, two good strikers, lots of power. This should be a really fun fight.
I'm really excited for this fight, but I'm going to say something kind of weird. It's going to be really one-sided. I just don't really know who's it going to be one-sided for, because there's two versions of this fight in my head right now. It's the Modestus Bukauskas goes out there, uses great lateral movement. He's able to sort of pick apart the holes in Olszewczuk's game and start to land around his guard and really use his movement to his advantage. The other half of this story is old Lord Michael goes out there and just marches forward and completely TKOs Bukauskas with like the first combo he throws. And I do think both of those situations are fairly likely, which is weird. Because for Olszewczuk, and you had mentioned it, he knows what strikes to throw, but he really only has like four different strikes that he does throw. And he just sort of mixes them up. He likes a right straight to the body, a left hook to the body, a right uppercut, and a left hook. That's pretty much all you're going to get for him. He will throw a few other techniques, but those are the major ones that you have to watch out for. I know that sounds simple enough, but the fact that he sort of simplified his game to only match those four tools is important, because you're not going to see him go out there and throw like a Charles Oliveira. Start throwing jumping crane kicks and whatnot. Second Oliveira shout out in these videos so far. He's a very basic striker if you just watch him. But what he's doing is high level. He's a very intelligent striker. And a lot of his fights, they're not lost on the feet. And that's for good reason. He does have insane power. He does have decent takedown defense. But again, that Jimmy Crute fight makes you worry. But I think that fight was more of a case of Jimmy Crute just a phenomenal grappler. And I know you can look at it two different ways. But I'm going to give Jimmy Crute a little bit of credit in that fight.
When I look at Michael Olszewczuk, it's like handing a first grader Stephen King's Under the Dome. At first, they're going to look at it and go, well, this is over 1,000 pages. And then they open it and they go, what? I have no idea what this is. And if you watch Olszewczuk's facial expressions when he's fighting Jimmy Crute, it's like, holy shit. I'm a fish out of water.
It's a good example. And again, it's hard to use the Jimmy Crute fight for either one of these guys because Jimmy Crute's in the top 15. He's going to beat a lot of guys in 205.
Good fighter.
So, yeah, exactly. There's no shame in losing to Jimmy Crute. The Open St. Preux fight was weird, though, because Ole Jaychuk was doing well to begin that fight, but the second he gets into that weird, like, I'm going to hold on to a guillotine, oh, wait, you're inside control, and I'm fighting Open St. Preux, I'm asleep. It's just weird, and his whole career's been odd, and that's the best way I can describe it. You look at what he was able to do to Khalil Roundtree, he completely exhausts him, he just looks phenomenal in that fight, honestly, but he was one juicy boy, so you don't really know how much that helped him in it. I think Ole Jaychuk will win this fight. I do think the version of this fight, of him sort of marching down Bukauskas and landing power eventually, is more likely than Bukauskas able to out-voluming Ole Jaychuk. And I mean that more because of the body work of Ole Jaychuk. I think he will be able to land something significant to the body that will either take away some of the gas tank in Bukauskas or hurt him outright. So it's a very hard pick to make. This is honestly the one that I'm teetering on the most on this card, but I think I'm going to side with Ole Jaychuk.
I agree with you. I disagree with the pick though. And that's where it gets weird because for me with Bukauskas, he also invests in the body, but he does it in different ways. He throws a really good lead kick to the body. He'll throw a lot of leg kicks too. I think if you chop down the base of Ole Jaychuk, this guy's a standing target. I mean, and that's a problem. It's not like takedown offense from Michael Olszewczyk. It's going to be a huge thing. And again, we talk about former common opponents for both these guys. They actually have two, and it's not just Ricardo Nasiglia. It's actually Marcin Wojcik as well, who finished Michael Olszewczyk. And for Modestus Bukauskas, if you look at the rise over the Cage Warriors, he beat him and finished him. The trouble for him in the fight against Wojcik, the fight against Nasiglia, it was a threat of the takedown and a lot of the takedowns. But for Bukauskas, I'm not really worried about that with Olszewczyk. And he's a more classically trained striker. He moves laterally a lot more. He's just a lot more physically sound. So, again, it's power versus technique for me. And I like Bukauskas with the technique. So, don't sweat the technique. Great song. We look at the odds. Bukauskas open to plus 134. He's now to plus 127. For Olszewczyk, open to minus 167. He's now minus 154. So we bring up the Tapology votes where it gets fun. And look at that, Matt. We hadn't looked at these previously. 1,149 of them. 48% Bukauskas. 51% by knockout. 38% by decision. The 52% that have Olszewczyk, 20% by decision. 70% by knockout. I've seen both these guys get finished before. Wouldn't be surprised if somebody went with, like, the under 2.5. I'm going Bukauskas.
It's nice to see the streets are hot on this fight, first of all. Just I hope both these guys get the credit they deserve. Because, listen, if Ole Jaychuk loses this and he for some reason gets cut on the three-fight losing streak, it's a damn shame. And if Bukauskas loses and the UFC decides to get rid of him, it's also a shame. Like, both these guys definitely belong to be in the UFC. I am going to pick Ole Jaychuk. I normally pick the guy with the most technique, but I do think this time power is going to win out. But again, I'm really excited for this fight. And when the majority of people think it's going to end via TKO or KO, you know it's probably going to be a good one.
Should be a great fight. I'm going Bukauskas. You're going with Olszewczyk. Should be an awesome one. And listen, you think this one's volatile? Look at our main event. You have Stipe Miocic taking on Francis Ngannou, the Predator. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. And a welcome back to two fighters who lost their respective UFC debuts. And listen, if you wanted to categorize their debuts like a play, it was more like Spider-Man turn off the dark. For Jared Gooden, it was back last year. He took on Alan Joban, lost his debut by unanimous decision. And for Abubakar Nurmagomedov, a little bit more decisive in his loss, if you could call it that. He took on David Zavada. He ended up losing by submission in the first round of that fight. And listen, if you talk about debuts, there's going to be some jitters. There's going to be some nerves. For Jared Gooden, it was really the fact that he was taking on an Alan Joban that kind of had one foot out the door. We hadn't seen Joban in quite some time in the octagon. He's been in that commentary role. He's, what, a helper? Would you call him a helper? He's a co-host of the MMA Heat podcast with Karen Bryant. But Alan Joban, you know exactly what you're going to get out of this guy. He's almost like a refined Mike Perry without the tattoos. He's going to go out there and he's going to put on a very impressive performance. And that's exactly what he did against Jared Gooden. Coming out of X3 Sports, we've seen him training out of Fusion XL as well. For Abubakar Nurmagomedov, listen, I've done a lot of tape study on this guy because you can't just take that one fight against David Zavada. Very highly regarded fighter. He's in that Khabib inner circle. We saw him in his debut actually have Khabib and really Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov in his corner, as well as Javier Mendez out of AKA. And there's a lot of praise going the way of Nurmagomedov. We'll talk about the odds later on, but we have to kind of get them out of the way here just early. He's more than a 2-1 favorite in this fight. But for me, from Abubakar Nurmagomedov, you know he's a combat sambo champion. He's a bronze medalist at Worlds. He's a Russian national champion. And we've seen it in his fights. Very good takedowns. And for him, listen, if you want to look at last weekend's fights, and a lot of people were very critical of this one, in Montserrat Conejo, she was all about the head and arm throwing, grabbing you and just taking you down and laying on top of you. If you watch Abubakar Nurmagomedov, nothing like that whatsoever. He goes for a single. He goes for a power double. He can strike. Little happy with his hands, and that's a major criticism that I actually have about him. For Jared Gooden, good forward pressure, a lot more single shots. He knows exactly where his power's at. And if you look at his last loss before he came into the UFC, it was actually to Bruno Oliveira, who we saw fight Carlos Ulberg on Contender Series. And really, Ulberg punched his ticket to the UFC off a win against Oliveira. All of that was standing. This is an interesting clash of styles because for Gooden, very much a striker, very technical. He can get a little hesitant, and sometimes that right check hook can kind of cause him a little bit of issues like it did in the Joban fight. For Nurmagomedov, though, and I'll let you lead from here, man, this guy, again, way too happy with his hands. We saw it in the Kush fight over with PFL. We also saw it in the fight. If you go way back, and listen, it's way back, and watch the fight against Magomed Mustafayev, Nurmagomedov's super cocky, and Mustafayev does his classic, well, I'm just going to throw spinning stuff at you, and I'm really going to attack you. And Mustafayev was super aggressive on the ground. Not really the reason why Nurmagomedov lost, because it was a weird cut that kind of just forced him out of the fight. It was a TKO loss, but honestly, I don't even know where the cut came from. There was a spinning back fist. It didn't even look like it landed. All this to say, Nurmagomedov is a great grappler, but he's not a great striker. Gooden's a great striker, maybe not the best grappler.
This fight really is the definition of a clash of styles. And I know when we talk about fights maybe on the main card, we say, oh, well, these guys are both really well-rounded and they can do everything. They're just kind of specialized in one thing or the other. For Nurmagomedov, he is going to want to get you to the ground. I like what you had said, too. He's not just dedicated to one kind of takedown. He is really good at going from single legs to double legs. He will throw in some clinch throws and whatnot, too. He won't just stick to them like we saw Ruiz do last week against Baez, but it is something that he can use if the traditional single or double legs aren't working. For good, and again, you had brought this up, you don't really know what we got from him in his UFC debut. Like, is that the Jared Gooden that we're going to see from this point on? Or was that a little bit of, this is ring rust and Alan Joban's not as shopworn as we thought? And you'll be hard-pressed to find a bigger Alan Joban than your boy over here. So, I was pretty happy with the performance all in all. But I do think that there were some things Jared Gooden can take from that performance that he can learn moving forward. He does need to up his activity to a certain degree. And I'm going to liken him to sort of a Paul Felder with his striking tempo. Just in the case that he doesn't throw a lot, but like you had said, he is very smart when he does decide to throw. My issue is, if he just stands there and looks his opponent in the mirror, he can get overwhelmed by volume, and that's going to be a big problem, especially in this division, if he is able to get this win and kind of move up the rankings a little bit. For Abubakar Nurmagomedov, I hope I said that name right, because normally I'm very bad at them. Brendan Schaub a lot of these. So to quote the undefeated and undisputed Chael Sonnen, Abubakar Nurmagomedov can weaponize his pace. If he's able to just do enough to make Jared Gooden tired. I know that sounds weird by just saying do enough, because for Nurmagomedov, he's going to have to mix in the striking with his wrestling. I don't think he's just going to go out there and blast a double leg on Jared Gooden, because one thing Gooden's really good at doing is meeting you halfway when you do try to shoot poor takedowns. He's got flying knees. He's got uppercuts. He's really good at those up-the-middle attacks we like to talk about when you are fighting wrestlers, the thing that we didn't think Derek Lewis is going to be able to do against Curtis Blaydes. But Jared Gooden, he's going to have these certain Goldilocks zones in this fight where if Nurmagomedov isn't careful, he could get slept. But I do think for Nurmagomedov, if he can push Gooden to the cage, it's as easy as that. I think a lot of his takedowns can be set up from that cage control, and if he is able to back Gooden up during this fight, I do think Nurmagomedov should have quite a bit of success.
We see Gooden use his length quite well, and I wrote that down in my notes, and then I went, well, he can use really good straight shots up the middle, but he doesn't really use them. Exactly. He uses more his length to kind of throw out those big looping shots. It's odd, and it's not something that we see a lot. He has a nice low base, which you think would lend credence to good takedown defense. And I mean, in the fight against Joban, that was just stand-up war. The other thing for Jared Gooden, this is a guy that took 21 pro fights from 2015 to 2020. And he talked about ring rust, and I know what you meant. Ring rust from the side of Joban, less from Gooden, yes. Because he had fought twice in 2020 already before he got the call-up. Very battle-tested, very worn. The really telling thing for Jared Gooden, the record of his opponents that he had won against 87-64. Not the best of records. And I know there was, what, a 3-13 peppered in there back in 2021. He beat Trent McCown, who was, what, 8-4 on his way to the UFC. For Abubakar Nurmagomedov, there's a lot of good names. Again, I mentioned Mustafayev early on. Are they the same weight class now? No, they're not. But still,
good win.
Decent fight. Well, he lost it. But fight to have. You look at the losses. Again, the Kush fight where, listen, he got rocked, and that was the trouble. If you go back and watch that fight, Kush is moving forward, and he just continues to land the uppercut, and Abubakar just stands there, and he shells
up. Which is a question I was going to ask you, actually. Do you think we're going to see Nurmagomedov get clipped at some point and kind of have that weird freeze deer in a headlight action that he sometimes can?
We've seen it in wins, too, and that's the issue for me. He'll get clipped, and then he just kind of stands there and freezes. We see a lot of fighters do it. Listen, if I got hit, I'd probably freeze too, or I'd drop and get knocked out. Like, I understand how it works. I'm not Abubakar Nurmagomedov. He's a world-class fighter in the UFC. But all I'm saying is, I've seen him get clipped and kind of just, stunned, and it'll happen. The Bojan Veličković fight, very close. Again, it was a draw. You're probably one of the bigger Bojan.
I love Bojan Veličković. Fun fact. I don't know why. I just think he never got a fair shake in the UFC, and I think he could get in the top 15 one day.
To have a draw like that on your record, listen, it's no shame. He's got wins over, listen, UFC caliber fighters. I know John Howard's one of those names that's there as well. Had a very good rank, fought Lorenz Larkin. And then you look at the last fight, and I want to focus on that one, because for Abubakar, listen, he fought David Zavada, and if you know anything about David Zavada, he's going to put on a fight of the night. His UFC debut, super high on him, and I said, listen, that fight against Danny Roberts, that's going to be a fight of the night. And people went, what? You're crazy. And then it was. But for David Zavada, I bet you if I hit him, or if the wind hits him in exactly the right direction, he's going to start to swell up. And the first punch that lands for Abubakar, it starts to swell around David Zavada's eye. And then Abubakar gets him down. David Zavada is slippery as all get out when he's on the ground. And it's not just in that fight because he finished it that way. If anybody gets David Zavada down, and he doesn't have the greatest of takedown defense, you're going to have a very good opportunity where you could get submitted. And in that fight, that's exactly how it ended up. I don't see Abubakar making mistakes like that. But again, if you look at the odds for this one, Nurmagomedov opened the favorite, and he's continued to climb. He opened a minus 169. He's about a minus 233 or thereabouts on best fight odds. And if you look at the line for Jared Gooden, and it's very difficult to say Gooden and not Gordon this far into it, plus 141 at open, plus 186 right now. I think Gooden has an opportunity. Anybody has a puncher's chance, especially a guy like Jared Gooden that closes distance so well, and he lands a lot of power early. But Nurmagomedov is such a good takedown artist that I have to go with the technique over the power. It's really tricky, though. And again, I don't think that line's all that fair because we haven't seen Nurmagomedov in, what, about a year and 4 months or thereabouts?
Been a while.
For Gooden, he's continued to fight. Obviously, I expect somewhat of a career progression from Nurmagomedov. He's only 31 coming into this one. But I will slightly side with the Russian in this fight.
So we brought up the Alan Jouban fight quite a bit, but I do think it's an important note to bring up. Gooden did hit Alan Jouban quite a bit in that fight. Like, Jouban's face took a lot of damage. It's not like he just got run over by Jouban. Like, he made a fairly good account of himself. And like you had said, he does carry that power really early, but it starts to diminish as the fight progresses. And a guy like Nurmagomedov, you know how good his pace is, you know how good his wrestling is. If he is able to, like I said, back up Jared Gooden, a lot of these wrestlers from Russia, that's basically what the game plan is. If I can back up to the fence, my takedowns become a lot easier from there. And you're trying to use the fence to get back up. And every single time, I'll keep on collapsing your base. If Nurmagomedov can use that game play in the first round, I expect completely exhausted Jared Gooden in the second round, and I like to make a bet off of that.
I had this in my notes. Now we waited all this time to use it. The lazy comparison is just the nickname, but if you watch the striking style, Abubakar Nurmagomedov stands completely straight up, and it is awkward to watch because it's almost like, hey, well, I trained with Khabib. I can kind of strike like Khabib a little bit. I have the same last name. And you watch him with his head straight up. Gooden could definitely, with those long arms, really close distance and cause issues. But, again, like I said, I'm going with Nurmagomedov as well. If we look at the Tapology votes, Matt, they're not all that close. We have, what, 1,000 votes or thereabouts, 78% Nurmagomedov, and you got the large majority, 74% by decision. So we're both going with Nurmagomedov in this fight. Very interesting card, a lot of moving pieces, and we're really looking forward to our main event between Stipe Miocic and Francis Ngannou for that heavyweight gold. Let's keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Bit of a head-scratcher of a fight, Matt, as we have former women's strawweight title challenger, how crazy is that, Jessica Penne, taking on 24K, Hannah Goldie. Matt, I don't know if we're going to have 24 karat magic in the air, head to toe, sub player, but solid. Matt, Hannah Goldie so far, I mean, what have we seen out of her? She's 5-1. She lost her UFC debut up a weight class, taking on Miranda Granger. And if you go back and watch that, Hannah Goldie's mostly known for her power, her footwork, and her volume. And in the fight against Granger, Granger just pushed her back and really kind of nullified all of the things that you like to see out of Hannah Goldie. Goldie cracked her a couple times, but overall, it just wasn't the Hannah Goldie that we were used to. From Jessica Penne, man, she's been gone for the longest time. And her last win, and I'll talk about it, was 6 years and 2 months ago against Randa Markos. Now, Randa Markos right now is about at the Artem Lobov stage of her career. You know, 22 have tried and 11 have succeeded. Something in and around that. For Penne, though, she beats Randa Markos. That was on the Ultimate Fighter finale. It was kind of like, hey, Aspires is going to fight Jan Jacek eventually. So we have to have somebody to title challenge for the title. And it was a fight of the night performance. And if you go back and watch it, it actually is a really good
really
fight.
Fun fight.
It's a lot of fun. And the thing that I like out of that one, it was 6 years and 2 months ago. But you could insert that fight into a current lineup and watch it. And it looks like the MMA of today. And that was the best part. Jessica Penne was almost ahead of her time. And then she fought the buzzsaw that was Joanna Champion. And oh my goodness, that was a lopsided title fight.
If you guys ever want to feel really bad for someone while watching MMA, I highly recommend you go back and watch that Joanna Jessica Penne fight. It's tough to watch. It really is. And Jessica Penne, in all of her best fights, is when she's fighting a fellow grappler or wrestler. Because I think we can both agree, when Penne gets a fight to the ground, she's tricky on the mat. She's great off the bottom. She's got good top position.
The commentary will say this about Jessica Penne. She's flexible and holy. Watch the things that she's like a contortionist on the ground.
And she's really good at going for those like omoplata sweeps and all those really weird things that you just don't see all that often in MMA. And when the division was first starting to settle, a lot of people did think, wow, Jessica Penne, she belongs at the top of this division. Of course, that's why she got a title shot. She has not been the same since that title shot though. And it has been unfortunate because you just look at the level of competition who she fought after that fight. She fought Jessica Andrade, and that fight went very similar to the Joanna fight, actually. Jessica Andrade hits her with a massive flurry, gets up against the cage, lands about 1,000 more punches. That's it for old Penne. Which isn't great that you've been TKO'd twice at 115 pounds, but anyways. Penne needs to fight a fellow wrestler. I really do think for her to have a win in the UFC, and it's unfortunate because I do agree with what you said. Even go back and watch her Invicta title fight against Michelle Waterson.
Some say best women's fight of all time.
Yuan and Wei Li would like to have a word with those people, but it was a really good fight. And the thing about that fight, it reminded me of Tim Elliott versus Louis Smolko. Weird comp, but just a fun scramble fest. And it was a really closely competitive fight. For Penne, though, she doesn't really have the wrestling to get the fight to the mat. She has some judo throws, but the problem with her judo throws is she doesn't have the striking to get into range to use her judo. So a lot of the times, she's just kind of forced to stand on the outside, be somewhat of an uncomfortable striker. And I know I talk about Jack Marshman all the time, Jack Hermanson when I say uncomfortable strikers. I think of him as like the best fighter who looks kind of uncomfortable on the feet. But you get the idea. When Penne is on the feet, she just doesn't really, she doesn't want to react to anything. She'll just kind of stand there and not do much. And if she is able to get into those clinch positions, she might be able to get the fight to the ground. But my issue with all those head and arm throws, and you see it in women's and men's MMA, you get your back taken pretty much automatically if you go for a head and arm choke. And it concerns me for her. If she's able to beat Hannah Goldie, that's great. You fought for a title. You should be able to beat Goldie, you would think, maybe. But if she does just come out the same fighter that we've seen her last 3 performances, even go back her last 5 performances, I don't know if there's many UFC caliber fighters that she's able to beat. And I know what we said in the Megan Anderson fight. If you don't have nothing nice to say, don't say it at all. But it is a little odd that the UFC has kept Jessica Penne when her last win is 6.5 years ago. Normally we talk about fighters and their last win was, you know, 8, 9, 7 years ago. We talk about BJ Penn, Anderson Silva, like some of the greatest fighters of all time who have had kind of a rough ending to their career, if you will. With Jessica Penne, she was a good strawweight who was ahead of her time, but it feels like the sport somewhat passed her by. And it's unfortunate to say that, but you don't get better at something by not doing it. And by not winning in 6.5 years, I doubt you're going to make yourself all that much better.
Now, I'm going to kind of go another way with it. So really, the focus is more so on Penne than it is on Goldie. And we'll get to Goldie for sure. But if you look at Penne, she's been at Alliance for the longest time. Her last loss was to Danielle Taylor, who's a decent wrestler, but mainly known as a volume striker, is Danielle Taylor. You watch her fight, she fights behind a jab, and she kind of circles away from the power hand. And for Penne, we're going to talk about this way too much, and I bet it lives on in my lexicon forever, and I'm going to compare her to everybody. But Montserrat Conejo, it's that exact same head and arm throw that Jessica Penne would use, except Conejo has such a heavy base that when she throws somebody down, she can stay on top and really weigh heavy. For Jessica Penne, she gets you down, she's going to be looking for something else. She's not just looking for that one position that Conejo's used her whole way up, and that's how she's focused her wrestling. For Penne, though, again, been at Alliance for the longest time. I mean, Angela Hill's over there now. There's a great stable of fighters in that San Diego area, especially around this weight class. For Penne, too, has the height advantage, has the reach advantage, former atomweight. For Hannah Goldie, you see it on the Instagrams. Really, it's weird. She's one of the most Instagram famous fighters that's out there that you wouldn't even think about. Heavily, heavily muscled, and I don't worry about her, you know, having the one-off at 125, moving back down. She's a strawweight. You see it in stature. You see it in the way that she fights. But again, a lot of volume, and if she needs to throw some power in there, she has it in her back pocket. So for me, Penne, yeah, her last fight was against Danielle Taylor, like I said, 3 years and 10 months ago. She's been off due to a weird USADA suspension. And when I say weird, it's really weird. She was originally supposed to be off for 4 years. They reduced it to 20 months. It's just, I don't have the particulars because I'm not USADA. I read up on it a lot, but it's weird.
People a lot smarter than the two of us are the people who actually look after the drug testing.
Back in 2019, she had two fights booked against one of the best boxers to ever step foot in MMA, in Jody Escobel. And she weighed in for the first one. She weighed at 118. They were still going to have the fight. And then the next day, the day of the fight, she sprained her ankle. So then they rebooked the fight. And then the USADA issues started to pop up.
Just the whole career of Jessica Penne has been very confusing. But again, on the flip side, to give Goldie her due, I do think she's the much better striker in this fight. And really, this fight for her, she can't get really close range with Penne because that's going to be her only way to get the fight to the mat. I understand she's going to have to from time to time. But for Goldie, if she goes in, I'm going to compare her to Wonder Boy. If she has that Wonder Boy mindset of, I'm going to get in, land my strikes, and then get out of range, I think she'll have quite a bit of success in this fight. I really do. Because for Penne, it's weird. Because we talk about Angela Hill, and she's one of those fighters who every time you see her fight, she does make improvements. And she might not always win every fight, but she'll be competitive with anyone in the top 15, no matter what. And again, there's always this evolution to her game. And then you look at the other sort of half of their women's strawweight roster, it's been the exact opposite. Now, maybe the last almost 4 years, Penne has made this massive overhaul to her game, but I do like Hannah Goldie in this fight.
I mean, for Penne to lose to Taylor, you go back and watch the fight, you look and see what you got out of Hannah Goldie. Listen, she beat Jillian Robertson in her pro MMA debut. Awesome stuff. I look at the odds, and some old head must have set these, and then automatically they changed. Because Penne opened a minus 185 favorite. She's now a plus 100 underdog. If you look at Goldie, opened a plus 160. She's now at a minus 124. And if we look over in Tapology, well, it's not all that close. 1,115 total votes, 80% Goldie, 90% by decision. If Danielle Taylor can win on the in and out, Hannah Goldie can win on the in and out.
Yeah.
Listen, maybe Jessica Penne has this wrinkle that we've never seen before in her game. Awesome. That would be the cat's behind. But I'll go with the fresher fighter and Goldie here. I know it's a bit of a cop-out, and if Penne wins, people are going to litter the comments section. Go for it. I'm going Goldie.
Unless Jessica Penne comes out like Charles Oliveira, and she's like, I'm done just being a middle-of-the-road fighter. Like, this is my time to get a title shot. I just don't see her winning this fight. And I agree with your assessment, too. If Goldie can follow somewhat of the same game plan that Taylor was able to, I do think she'll be able to win this
fight. Both of us going with 24-carat Hannah Goldie to get the win. Really looking forward to the card. We have that title fight for the Goldie, but not for Hannah Goldie. We're just talking about belts here. Stipe Miocic taking on Francis Ngannou for the second time. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time banger at light heavyweight, Matt. We have Atomic Alonzo Menifield taking on William the Nightmare Knight. This should be an awesome fight. We already previewed it a number of weeks ago. Preview's still perfectly fine. We just did the fight rebooked to UFC 260. So we'll throw it back to that original preview and prediction. We'll update the odds and make a final pick on this one. Very interesting and explosive fight at light heavyweight. We have Alonzo Menifield taking on the Nightmare, William Knight. Matt, for William Knight, he was one of those guys like a Greg Hardy, like a Chase Hooper. He had a developmental deal to come into the UFC. he was such a big deal on the regional scene. I remember when he was coming up and everybody figured this is a guy that's going to end up in the UFC. So he goes back to CS. He was even kind of like the guest, an analyst that they would have on some of their programming. I remember going back, watching some fights to try and get ready for some of these cards and doing up my notes. There's William Knight on the mic. And it was kind of interesting. So he goes into a big time fight with Tafan Chukwe, who we now know is insanely powerful.
He's all right.
And very, very talented. And he gets finished in that fight. And it was a weird back and forth. It was a good fight. If you want to go back and watch a good fight, that's a one, especially if you're a big Tafan Chukwe fan or a Lloyd Irvin fan. But go back and watch that one. For Knight, loses that fight and then comes back very quickly and picks up a knockout win over Rocky Edwards, which is impressive. It's a name that a lot of people know. Then he comes on to Contender Series and he finishes Cody Brundage. Then he comes out like 2 weeks after that, and he fights a really interesting prospect in Alexa Kammer in a fight that a lot of people figured it's going to be a knockout. It's going to end very, very quickly. And he beats Alexa Kammer by decision. And for William Knight, not having the full training camp, not having all that time to think, well, geez, this guy's a strong style guy. He trains with Stipe Miocic. He's a main training partner and a great striker. He goes in there, and I don't like this, and this is where I'm going with it. He keeps his head up, his hands down, and walks forward. He didn't need a ton of shots, and especially at the end of the first round, he almost had Kammer rocked. But he worked the clinch. He worked the takedown. He really wore on Alexa Kammer to the point where he just wore and wore and get into great positions. He would get into mount. He would really work his entire game plan. And to me, it was kind of the evolution of William Knight. Oh, this guy isn't the fighter that we thought he was. He isn't just the knockout artist. He can do a lot of things that maybe we wouldn't have seen before if he had a full camp for Alexa Kammer. For Alonzo Menafield, well, really, William Knight's just the Alonzo Menafield that we thought we were going to get. Because for Alonzo Menafield, he came in and had the win on Contender Series. He beat Deshaun Boatwright, who was 3-0. Then he fought a really tough out in Vinicius Mojea.
Don't know if that's a tough out.
Knocked him out cold. And then he fought Paul Craig. And Paul Craig, I mean, listen, you might not like him. You might love him. But Paul Craig shouldn't be throwing spinning kicks to the body against Alonzo Menafield. Menafield duck in, knocked him out. Then he fought Devin Clark, and Devin Clark wore on him and won a pretty one-sided decision. Good fight for Devin Clark. Smart fight for Devin Clark. So then Alonzo Menafield comes out and fights with Vincent St. Preux. And I know, and I'll kind of let you take it from here, because it was a classic OSP fight.
Was it ever.
Where he didn't take down Menafield. They kind of stared at each other. Menafield did the old duck away from power, and then he would try to land his own shots. You saw OSP landed straight down the pipe, and it just kept touching him with that jab. And then finally lunge, knocked him out. That was pretty much it. Sorry.
I mean, yeah, that's how the fight went. This fight's weird. I gotta be honest. Here's the thing. William Knight and Alonzo Menafield will never be champions. And it's unfortunate to say, but you bring up Alexa Kammer, and I gotta be honest. Alexa Kammer is like Jacob Malkoon. The only reason people know who he is because of who he's training with. It's not because of how good he really is. I think William Knight looked good against him, don't get me wrong. But the fact that that's his biggest win doesn't prove to me that he's going to be Alonzo Menafield. And here's the thing. Alonzo Menafield's best win, like you said, is against Paul Craig. But even that fight was kind of weird. And not that Alonzo Menafield's as odd as a fighter as OSP, because OSP, his fights make zero sense at all. But even look at the OSP fight. Menafield comes in, he starts out, he's doing well, he's pressuring Ovin St. Preux. And then Ovin St. Preux, like you had mentioned, very Uriah Hall-esque, just keeps on putting out the jab, keeps on putting out the jab. And every single time OSP threw pretty much anything, it would land on Menafield. Because Menafield has this weird thing where he does pressure his opponent, but he's not fast enough to get out of the way of their counter shots. He won't be able to have that fast switch where it's okay, I'm going to stalk my opponent, and then I can actually flinch between my sort of defensive settings and my offensive settings. Menafield does stand there just to get hit, and that's a really big issue when you are fighting at really any weight class, but especially at 205, when you do expect to fight the OSPs of the world, when you are going to fight the William Knights of the world. Like, here's another great example. Jamal Hill, who does not have very much experience, was able to go out there and put away a guy like OSP. He was able to really download his game plan, figure out what worked and what didn't work, and we saw what an upper-level prospect can do to someone like OSP. Alonzo Menafield had a very similar beginning to the fight like Jamal Hill did. The difference was he couldn't make the adjustments, and that's the problem with Menafield. He doesn't make adjustments mid-fight, and that's a big problem. And William Knight, it's the thing. He can go out there and just strike. He can be the big power guy, but he can go in there and clinch. And if you're Menafield and you're not expecting a clinch-heavy game plan from William Knight, you might just get sapped of all your energy early on. And we've seen Alonzo Menafield fatigue in fights. This is not going to be a fight where, oh, wow, Menafield's going to come in with phenomenal cardio.
This is such a weird fight because, again, Alonzo Menafield comes from the much more credentialed gym. He's a Fortis MMA guy. So as far as in-fight adjustments, one of the best gyms in the world for that. Some of the best cornering. We've seen Saif Saud in his corner in the past. And really, he hasn't had to have much in terms of in-fight game planning. Because again, first round finish. It's been 7 first round finishes. You look at one of the big wins, Kadjimurad Bestayev, a guy that's 10-4 now. You look at the guy the names that guy's fought. And again, his last loss was on Contender Series in 2020 against Phil Hawes. But Alonzo Menafield's beaten some decent fighters, and he's beaten the guys you would want a big prospect to beat. Mohea, Paul Craig, and then he's matched up with Trevor Smith, again, Devin Clark, and OSP. So it's kind of tricky. Like, where is Alonzo Menafield? It's going to be the measuring stick fight for William Knight as well. And if you look at his record, again, a lot of first-round finishes as well. He has the one finish over Herdem Alekbek in the third round. But other than that, first round, Rocky Edwards third round, and then the decision is last time out. I like that decision. I know that tips my hand a little bit, but I do like that. I like that added wrinkle to his game because, again, they're both strikers, so who's got more? Who can show me more? Anybody can knock anybody out. You saw that last weekend, Curtis Blaydes, Derek Lewis. I mean, listen, I'm still getting the mentions of how could you guys not see that? It was one or the other, and one of them happened. So back with it, again, for Menafield, interesting fight. I mean, he's on a 2-fight losing streak. For William Knight, he's a ways away from that Chukwe loss, and he's actually on a nice, tidy 3-fight win streak. So if we look at the odds for this one, listen, it's pretty much pick'em odds at this point. You had Knight open to minus 135. He's now minus 112 or thereabouts. For Menafield, open to plus 115. He's now at a minus 112. So again, basically pick'em odds. This should be a really good one, and it's a great matchup. It's just a shame one of these guys has to lose. So overall, what are you thinking here?
I'm gonna pick William Knight. I do think his power will land eventually. And for Menafield, he does fight at one of those weird paces where I never know if he just doesn't have good cardio or if he does have good cardio for like 3 minutes and then forgets how to breathe properly, I guess. He's just a very odd fighter, Menafield is. And when you do go through and look and watch all of his fights, it's not that he really changes throughout every fight. It's just the opponent does. I think William Knight will be able to land something significant at some point.
Matt, I'm also going with William Knight in this one, not changing from the original pick. I think it should be a very interesting matchup. So both of us going with William Knight to get the win. You're going to want to keep it locked in for our main event and the rest of the main card. We have Stipe Miocic taking on Francis Ngannou in the main event for that heavyweight strap. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Really hoping that the fight gods don't take this fight away from us because, of course, Jamie Mullerkey's good buddy Alexander Volkanovski was originally supposed to be in our co-main event against Brian Ortega. He's off the card. His good buddy out of City Kicks Boxing, Shane Young, is also off the card, who's supposed to be taking on Omar Morales. Now that one, again, cross your fingers, maybe we still get the fight. But for Jamie Mullerkey, doesn't train out of City Kickboxing. He's out of, and I toss it down, Central Coast MMA. Ross Pearson, a coach at that gym. Volkanovski spends time between the two with Central Coast and City. And that's why I just worry about Jamie Mullerkey. And it's weird because there's so many ties that run deep. Mullerkey, of course, out of Central Coast in his UFC debut, takes on City Kickboxing's Brad Riddell. And in that fight, it was a good one. Wow. It was actually a fight of the night. And if you go back and look at the judges' scores, 29-27, 30-26, 30-26. You don't often see a fight of the night that's one-sided like that. But it was a good fight. Mullerkey was able to land a few takedowns. Riddell's takedown defense is pretty good. And once he gets to the mat, he usually pops right back up. So that one, it was an interesting fight. And then if you go back and you look at Jamie Mullerkey's last time out, it wasn't that long ago that we saw him. It was about 4 months ago against Fares Ziem, France's own. He lost the decision in that one. But again, he worked in a lot of the takedowns. And for Ziem, very, very good kickboxer. Taking on a totally different fighter right now in the Death Star, Kama Worthy. And Matt, we have to say this. We have to be honest. Took Kama Worthy to beat Otman Zaitsev. Super wrong in that one. And the thing for Kama Worthy, you look at all of the losses, they're all by finish, all 7 of them. He's been submitted once, he's been knocked out or TKO'd 6 times. You don't love to see it. That was the first one against the Zaitsev that was back up at 155. He had a great run at 45. Not so much in the regional scene, but it was what it was. Hadn't been finished at 55. And then he comes up and he loses to a Zaitsev and gets outboxed, and it wasn't great to see. So, new matchup for both guys. Totally different clash of styles. For Kama Worthy, you know exactly what you're going to get. A lot of explosive movements out in front. For Jamie Mullerkey, a lot of defensive movements, I would say. A lot of takedowns. He plays it a little bit safe. He can get into those striking wars, but he's more of a safe fighter. So for me, It is an interesting fight. What are you thinking here?
This should be a fun fight, but again, this fight really comes down to, can Malarkey take down Kama Worthy? Because if he just stands, listen, I get it, Ottman Zaitar knocked him out, and he didn't look that good in that fight. He is a very good striker, though, and it is important when you bring up the fact that a lot of his finished losses are down at 145. I do think Kama Worthy is a great example of a fighter who, when they cut too much weight, that's when their chin does start to at least feel the effects of it. We've seen that a lot in the UFC. When guys move up in weight, they fight a more natural weight class. Robert Whittaker is a great example. Now, 185, he gets hit, and I guess he still goes down and just pops right back up. For Worthy in his last fight, he did look bad, but I do think you kind of have to take that fight out because Malarkey doesn't fight at all like Ottman Zaitar. You couldn't find a more polar opposite MMA fighter. Malarkey, it's weird. You go back and look at that Riddell fight. He actually kind of rocks Riddell on the feet, and it's weird because you would never think that Jamie Malarkey would be able to rock someone like Brad Riddell. But the fact that the takedown is such a threat when you're fighting Malarkey, it will open up some shots for him. He's not a terrible striker. He does strike in sort of a stiff manner, if you will, where he doesn't have this fluidity like a guy like Adesanya has, but he does go out there and he knows what he's good at. And I think that's a really important thing. Like, I wouldn't want Danny Green on my basketball team anymore, I guess. When he was a Raptor, I was happy. But he just knows where to go and what to do. And I think that's important. And I think Malarkey is an example of that. He knows what to do at which stage of the fight. I think he's got better cardio than Kama Worthy as well. And if he is able to get these takedowns early, I do think Jimmy Malarkey has a somewhat basic path to victory. But again, you're going to have to go out there and take down Worthy, who does have decent takedown defense. And you're going to be eating bombs on your way in. And that's the thing for Worthy. Not only does he have great power on the feet, he has great defensive strikes to defend against takedowns. We talk about the elbows like Travis Brown, knees and whatnot. Worthy's just a really wonky striker, and I'll be honest, I've never had the best read on his career. It seems like every time he's won the UFC, I picked him to lose, and every time he's lost, I picked him to win, so I'll just let that out right now. I think this is a tough stylistic matchup for Malarkey. I really do. We've seen him in there with other guys who have big power, good volume, and good hand speed. All those things Kama Worthy has, and he does eat too many shots, and for me, that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Jimmy Malarkey eats punches like they're going out of style. Like, he's never going to get another one thrown at him. And it's very concerning when you're fighting a guy who's got big power like Kama Worthy.
Let's bring these numbers up, Matt. In the Fares-Ziem fight, 3-29-28. He went 5-11 on his takedown attempts. And he had 6 minutes and 56 seconds of control time. You like that. Good leg kicks, too. And he is a good leg kicker. You need to know that. Kama Worthy switches it up with the footwork, though. So, listen, will the leg kicks take a big effect? They might. I mean, Kama Worthy has very skinny legs. So do I. If you look at the fight that he had against Brad Riddell, again, a fight of the night. But the troubling stat, and you got to take it with a grain of salt again, because Jamie Malarkey's only been in there for 2, and he lost them both. For Kama Worthy, he's been in there for 3. One of them was really short. Well, actually, 3 of them were pretty short. But if you look at it overall, the strike differential, 1.87 given to 4.6 taken for Jamie Malarkey. And if you look at it the other way, 4.12 to 3.69. A positive differential for Worthy, small sample size. A negative and a big negative for Malarkey, small sample size, who's also been finished by Alexander Volkanovski. Great to see that they've kissed and made up. For me, again, you look at the odds on this one. Malarkey opened to plus 165. He's now plus 109. So the money's coming in on Malarkey. If you look at Worthy, open to minus 190. He's now minus 134. And if you have a look at the total Tapology votes, Matt, 1,141 of them, 87% Worthy, 71% by knockout. That's wild.
That's a crazy percentage split. It really is. And I don't know if he will be able to TKO Malarkey, because you see him in there with big power guys again. I think Brad Riddell probably hits harder than Kama Worthy, and he wasn't able to TKO Malarkey, but it has been a lot of damage in only 2 UFC fights. I do expect Kama Worthy to get the win. I won't say easily, because I do think that there is somewhat of a game plan for Malarkey to win if he's able to go out there and really implement his wrestling, but if this fight's on the feet for any period of time, Malarkey's in a lot of danger.
I've got Worthy as well. Again, if Malarkey's going straight takedown, there's a lot of shots up the middle for Worthy. I really think Worthy also has an underappreciated ground game as well. So I will side with the American here. Both of us going with the Death Star, Kama Worthy, to get the win. It should be a great fight. Really interesting stylistic matchup. And in our main event, a rematch between Stipe Miocic and the man himself, the Predator, Francis Ngannou. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
On our main card, a big-time banger between a couple of guys that have really been hot and then not. We have Sugar Sean O'Malley taking on Thomas Almeida. And Matt, for Thomas Almeida, it's been a while since he got that shine. It really has. 1-4 in his last 5. He's been finished in fights. He had a long layoff between his second-to-last fight and his last one against Jonathan Martinez, which was last year. And if you go back and you look at that fight, I mean, Thomas Almeida really looked like a different fighter. He did. I mean, he wasn't as aggressive as he normally was. He was looking to counter. He was throwing some nice leg kicks to the lead leg of Martinez, who was fighting out of that rangy southpaw stance. ultimately lost the fight. He got out volume. The pressure Martinez was really there. It was a classic John and the Martinez, I didn't get knocked out by Davy Grant type of fight. And for Sean O'Malley, his last time out, it was weird. And there were so many question marks that came out because we've seen it from Sean O'Malley. He was 12-0 going into that one, and there were doubters out there. There was the hype train and all of that. But for Sean O'Malley, he loses to Marlon Vera in a fight where he backed up and kind of tweaked his knee a little awkwardly, and it looked like, oh boy, like was it an ACL, PCL, MCL? It was an injury. Nonetheless, he did hurt himself. Vera started to try and capitalize on it with the kicks as well. But if you look at it for O'Malley, a lot of people went back to his amateur days. Oh, well, he got rocked before. He got TKO before. It's going to happen in fights. But we did see it in that one where Vera landed that crazy elbow from the clinch. Didn't put O'Malley out, but the referee stepped in and stopped it nonetheless. Now, is O'Malley still claiming that he's undefeated? Yes, he is. He did so in our chat in one of the episodes of Question Mark Kicks. Is he undefeated? Hell no, he's not. He lost impressively to Marlon Vera, who would lose impressively to Jose Aldo. So this is a weird fight. It's more of a crossroads fight for Sean O'Malley than it is for Thomas Almeida. But for Almeida, this is an opportunity to gain relevance once more. So for me, it's a very interesting fight. I want to get your thoughts on it.
I'm going to disagree with your assessment of Almeida. I really do. I think it's over for him being an elite MMA fighter. It is, because you don't leave 2 years of your prime between 27 and 29 because you're getting better.
No, I mean, the guy had major eye surgery.
He learned how to speak English, too. But again, my issue with Almeida is the same problems are still there. He doesn't have the best chin, and that's always going to trouble him. And I know that it's going to be one of those situations we just talked about with Kyle Worthy, for instance, where at 145, Jonathan Martinez landed good shots, and he wasn't rocking Almeida. He was stunning him, don't get me wrong. He felt those shots, but he wasn't putting them down. And then you look at Thomas Almeida at 135. When he gets hit clean, he goes down. And it's as simple as that. And it's not like I'm trying to over-exemplify his issue. It's true. Like, when he gets hit clean, he gets rocked every single time. Jimmy Rivera, I don't want to say has no power in his hands, because for some reason the broadcast likes to bring up about how heavy-handed he is, even though he's only got, like, 3 TKO wins. Don't get me started. But Jimmy Rivera dropped Thomas Almeida twice in their fight and rocked him in the second round, which is the only time he didn't drop Almeida. When Jimmy Rivera is dropping you consistently in your fights, I'm going to start to worry about your durability. And you say a lot of things about Sean O'Malley. Does he have a nickname that's overused? Yes, he does. Does he have weak ankles? Yes, he does. It was a kick that did hurt his leg in the Vera fight. It's not like he tweaked his knee, so he is susceptible to leg kicks if he is hit clean. We've seen it happen before. It happened in the Andre Sukumtov fight where he hurt his leg. Now, that happened closer to the end of the fight, too, so he was able to sort of work his way out of it, and it wasn't stopped. But in the Vera fight, it was weird, and that whole fight was odd, because when he did start to move forward in the early stages of that fight, he was having a little bit of success, but it's not like it was this, oh, look how good O'Malley was looking until he hurt his foot. It was a pretty tit-for-tat fight until he hurt his foot, so a lot of people out there are like, oh, Vera only beat him because he hurt his foot. That's not the case at all. Marlon Vera is a very good fighter, and again, he's even closer to the top 15 than when I'd say like a 20 to 15 guy. Like, he should be in the top 15 right now if he's not. But for Almeida, it's always going to be that same issue of durability, especially at 135. And it's going to be hard for me to pick him at a fight at 135 until he shows me something different. Because up until this point, he gets hit clean, he goes down, it's very simple. For O'Malley, though, there's a lot of question marks in his game, and this will be an interesting case because I think this is the first time he's going into a fight fighting a guy who at least technically is somewhat on the same level of him as a pure striker. O'Malley might do a little bit more. He might be a little bit more active with his footwork especially, but for the most part, Almeida is a very technically sound fighter. My issue still always comes back to the fact that unless he is perfect with his technique, it doesn't get hit at all. I just think if you hit Almeida clean, eventually he gets put down. I don't care who you put him in there with. And I think O'Malley will be able to replicate that game plan. Here's the other thing, too. A lot of people like to say the UFC is very different than boxing and how they're not similar. They know what they're doing. They're giving Sean O'Malley a favorable matchup against a guy who, A, isn't going to take him down. B, doesn't have the most thunderous leg kicks. He has good leg kicks, don't get me wrong. But for Almeida, he's not really like an Edson Barbosa, as an example, where he's really digging that shin in. He will use them, but it's more of an accumulation than just that one shot to the leg. So I think the UFC knows what they're doing. They're putting O'Malley in there with another pure striker who isn't that durable. So I really like O'Malley in this fight.
I mean, as far as not durable, his last fight, he's pretty durable. And he ate some shots, like you said, against Jonathan Martinez. The other thing for Thomas Almeida, if you go back and you watch the run, you watch the Brad Pickett fight, Thomas Almeida's out there for blood. I mean, you watch the way that he fights. I mean, you talk about technique. It's there. It's sound. But he's going after you. From the time that the referee goes, let's get it on, if it was Big John McCarthy, he's going for it. And he either knocks you out or gets knocked out. That was the story for Thomas Almeida. He had the long layoff between the Rob Font loss and the fight against Jonathan Martinez. He had the major eye surgery in 2019. He had different issues that he worked through. Again, he talked about it. Almost perfect English. Training for this one, again, out of Shoot the Box, Diego Lima. Love that for him. And then again, you watch the way that he fights in that one against Martinez. Is he a little hesitant? Yeah, he's been off for a long time. But I did like the fact that he had a really nice high guard. There weren't a lot of shots that could get through. The one that did work out very well for Martinez, he just kept pumping that jab out there. Long southpaw stance. You know Martinez is going to throw those body kicks. He might throw a few of them high. Didn't throw a lot of leg kicks. But again, Almeida did a good job of attacking the lead leg of Martinez. Could he do that against O'Malley? It's going to be a different trajectory where he's fighting an orthodox fighter, a guy that can fight out of both stances in O'Malley. So I'll be interested to see how that works out. And again, Almeida's a great counter-striker too. So that's what makes this very interesting. I'm fine with the takedown defense for Almeida. For O'Malley, very good jiu-jitsu. We see that. You see all the videos on the Instagrams and such. You know exactly what he can do. And we've seen that all the way up. Level of competition isn't near as high as it has been for Almeida. You go with the five on in. Tarion Ware, craziest run in the UFC history. Sukum Toth in the fight where he hurt his ankle and then he was down on the ground and the referee didn't stop it. Then he goes out there and beats Jose Alberto Quinones, who seems to get knocked out by a lot of people. And then he knocks out Eddie Wineland, which it was cool.
It was.
And people liked it. That's great. But he goes in there against Vera, who's what? He's been a fringe guy for a long time. On his best day, he's a top 15 fighter. On his worst, he's probably a 30 to 35 guy. Like Marlon Vera can be hot and cold when we see him. But in the fight against O'Malley, he just stood straight up. He kind of went punch for punch, like you said. And then as soon as that knee started to buckle, he started to walk O'Malley down and he had a ton of success. Almeida, as long as he's not on his back foot, he can find success in this one. So if we look at the odds, Matt, for this one, you have Sean O'Malley opening a minus 250 favorite. He's now a minus 321. For Almeida, plus 210, now to plus 250. And if we look at the Tapology votes, 1,254 of them, 83% O'Malley, 84% by knockout. I know where you're going, but what are you thinking?
Okay, I'm going to compare Thomas Almeida to Justin Gaethje because they have one similarity and they have one massive difference. They're two guys who were known for getting into wars outside the UFC. The difference is that when Justin Gaethje started to lose by TKO, when he lost to Eddie Alvarez, when he lost to Dustin Poirier, he knew, okay, I have to make a change and I have to be a much more defensively sound fighter. I still have my power. I still have all my great leg kicks and whatnot, but I need to defend my head better. Thomas Almeida has never made that choice. He did up 10 pounds against a guy who isn't going to sniff the top 15. I understand. I said he was going to be in the top 15 in any weight class he chose, but that's not going to be the case. For Almeida, this is my issue. He wore too much of his chin out in the amateurs, if you will, where... And O'Malley, listen, your foot can get hurt. It's really hard to say if your leg's going to give out in a fight and if it's not. For Almeida, though, even at the Brad Pickett fight, Brad Pickett drops Thomas Almeida multiple times in that fight. Something you probably should bring up. Breaks his nose, too. Not a great sign because even then Brad Pickett was close to 40. I think there's a lot of greats from Thomas Almeida, and I was one of those people who thought in his initial run, wow, this guy can be champ one day, he's going to knock out Cody Garbrandt, he's going to go up and beat Dominic Cruz, it's going to be the Thomas Almeida era. I can admit when I'm wrong, and I was very wrong about that. I just think Thomas Almeida, he was that guy before he came into the UFC, and he let too much of his shine go. And it's unfortunate because I do think that he had a really high ceiling. I just think with all the damage he's taken, he's not the same fighter, and for that reason, I have to pick O'Malley.
Matt, I have a really hard time with this one. I really do. I mean, again, you're going to get so much public support on Sean O'Malley, and if you pick him, you're going to get labeled, you know, you're a hype beast. You like Nike Air Maxes. You're out there for the Jordans. You're waiting for the Hyperlights. Do people buy Hyperlights? Do they get excited for it? I don't think they do either. But you're out there looking for Sean O'Malley. For me, it is a lot more difficult than that because for O'Malley, we've seen it. The knees, the legs, they've been an issue. And for a guy that can toss out the leg kick in Thomas Almeida, I love it. For me, I would wait, see what the first round looks like, even if we get past the first round. But I am going to go with Brazil's own Thomas Almeida in this fight. I'm going to go with a big underdog in this one. I think he's going to be able to get it done. If he can withstand the first round against O'Malley, I think he can make it all the way through. And I really do think that he's made a lot of strides in his game where he's kind of moved around between camps. He spent a lot of time in Texas before his last one. He's moved back over with Shoot the Box Diego Lima. I think there's a lot of things to like out of his game. And again, I like that nice high guard, and I think he's made enough defensive improvements that I'm gonna go Almeida. You're gonna go with Sean O'Malley. Really contentious one. Let us know down below in the comments section what you're thinking. Who are you going with? Are you going with Sugar Sean O'Malley? Are you going with Tominas? Thomas Almeida should be a great fight on a great card. Really looking forward to our main event between Stipe Miocic and the man himself, Francis Ngannou. Let's keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. Gut Bush? You definitely do if you haven't tried the best products from our sponsor today. It's, of course, Manscaped. After using these life-changing products, listen, you're going to want to join a ball sack beauty contest. I'm looking out for you, too, because I also have an exclusive 20% off discount code. Use the code FMP at manscaped.com. Matt, we've all been there before. Listen, you're a shower shaver, and I talk about it week in and week out. And I still am. I haven't changed my plan. I haven't just started shaving in the backyard, shaving in the sink.
I'm sure your neighbors appreciate it.
Still a shower guy. And for me, it's Lawnmower 3.0. The LED light that's there, you can hear it. That's great stuff. And the big bonus is the light. I mean, listen, it's got a ceramic blade. You're not going to nick your nuts, this and that. But if I can actually see what I'm doing, I'm going to end up with less problems. And we've all been there. I bought that cheap kind of set that you can buy at the big box store, and it gets rusty, it gets gross, you forget to oil it. Like, there's a lot of issues that can arise, and I don't want tetanus. So, yeah, I've been there before with the cheap stuff. This is waterproof. You can use it in the shower. It's not a big deal. They're dedicated to helping you level up your full body grooming game with the perfect package 3.0. And if you go with it, you get the shit. And who doesn't need a nice toiletry bag? Listen.
It's nice.
The world's going to eventually open up. And I am the type that really likes to have a nice toiletry bag. The other thing, this used to be a talking point for these folks, but the charging stand. And listen, we're still doing Zoom stuff. You're still on Skype. You're still on Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp. I don't know, whatever else your Overeem used to use. And listen, you're parading yourself around your house. If you've got that on your bathroom, I don't know, if you got it hanging out,
your fireplace,
it's a good look. A nice charging stand can make a big difference. It's definitely the best trimmer that you can get to help trim and groom the hedges, and it also features, like I said, a cutting edge ceramic blade to help reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin safe technology, which was pioneered by Manscaped. When you trim the hedges, the tree stands taller. If you're a grower, not a shower, that's very important.
If you want rusty nuts, go ahead, click away. That's fine with us. You don't have to. But if you want the best male grooming tool out there, try Manscaped out.
Matt, they also have in the perfect package the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. I tell you every week, slap that stuff on there. It works great. They also have the Crop Reviver. Now, this is starting to get a little bit less.
Might need
a little bit more, but it's a nice little spritz. I won't spritz it out there today, but you just toss that stuff on your nuts. It's good stuff as well. They also have the Weed Whacker in the package. You see me do this every week, but I'll trim my nose here on camera.
How fast does it grow?
It grows pretty fast. It's always grown pretty fast. And if you do get the perfect package, it also comes with the Shed Travel Bag as well as the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped boxers. And if you head over to their website as well, they also have the greatest refined cologne. It's that great Manscaped scent. It's good stuff there, too. So get 20% off and free shipping using the code FNP at manscaped.com. Do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for your bush trimming experience. Matt, let's keep it going with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Really interesting fight on our main card, UFC 260. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFMP. With me, as always, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at MattAllenFNP. And Matt, we got one of your guys, the silent assassin Vicente Luque, taking on, well, really, when I was a fight fan, one of my guys in the chosen one, Tyron Woodley. And it might sound silly because a lot of people, you look at the recent losing streak, you look at the way that he fought against Kamaru Usman when he lost his belt. There was a time when Tyron Woodley was in the hearts and minds of many. And then he got big and then things didn't really go all that well. And the fights weren't all that interesting and a lot of people got turned off at Tyron Woodley. Now, a lot of people kind of sweep that Darren Till fight under the rug and forget about it. But at one point or another, Tyron Woodley was a mother effer, and you watch some of those fights. I know a lot of people like to talk about the Josh Koscheck fight. That was back in November of 2013. We're a ways removed from that. The fight against Carlos Condit was absolutely insane for as long as it lasted. Then he goes on, beats Robbie Lawler, has a draw against Wonder Boy. They rematch. He beats Damian Maia in a boring fight again. And then the Till fight. Then he loses to Usman. He loses to Burns. Emphatically, Burns took him down. Always a Tyron Woodley staple is his takedown defense. And then he fights Colby Covington and gets totally outclassed. Now he's fighting Vicente Luque. Matt, on Vicente Luque's record between exhibition and pro, he has a loss to Haider Hassan, who's barely even a 500 fighter, and he knocked out Thiago Santos, yeah, that Thiago Santos, at 170 pounds. The guy's had an absolutely crazy career. If you look at the names on Vicente Luque's record, nowhere close to Tyron Woodley. But wins against Bilal Muhammad, Nico Price, two times. Brian Barberena, crazy fight. Derek Krantz, Mike Perry, and his last time out, Randy Brown. And listen, I'm a lot higher on Randy Brown than most people. He's a very long-rangey striker. He has very, very deceptive jiu-jitsu. And he's just an all-around good fighter. He just doesn't really get a lot of credit. Vicente poured it on him and looked amazing in that fight. So, for Vicente Luque, he comes into this one at about a 2-1 favorite, which is kind of crazy. He opened a 2-1. He's now minus 257. For Woodley, open 205, about 205. So the odds are kind of weird in this one. It's wild to me that Tyron Woodley's fighting in the year of our Lord, 2021, at a 2-1 underdog to Vicente Luque.
So let me take you back. We're going to have to go all the way back to UFC 205, the first time Woodley fought Wonderboy. One of the first fights on that card was Vicente Luque versus Bilal Muhammad, when no one knew who either one of those guys was. Luque, of course, knocks him out with one of the nicest check left hooks you're ever going to see. And he just kind of is off to the races from that point on. You look at the losses that Luque has in the UFC, he's only lost to Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Leon Edwards in the UFC. That's insane. That is number 3 and 5, I believe, respectively, in the UFC rankings. And that means a lot. And the other great thing about Luque, too, and I sound like I'm fanboying a little bit. Listen, I've been a fan of this guy for a while, and he's not a fighter that I ever thought would be at the top of the UFC like he has been. And for the fact that he went, knocks out Muhammad, loses to Leon Edwards emphatically, just kind of gets out-wrestled in that fight. I remember going into that Nico Price fight, I was like, okay, hopefully we see a better version. Mops the floor with him. And right now, Luque is on, and I'm going to bring him up for the third time because he's been fresh in my mind because I wanted to bring him up for this video. When Charles Oliveira beat a bunch of guys who weren't ranked and finished them all, we were like, okay, he's good, but we don't know how good he is. And then he fights Tony Ferguson, beats the brakes off him in a not competitive fight whatsoever. And now we realize, like, oh, Charles Oliveira is that guy. Luque is on a very similar winning streak to Charles Oliveira. When you put him in there with guys right in the top 15, he's going to hurt them. Let's just be honest. If a guy isn't ranked, he shouldn't be fighting Vicente Luque. He's got absurd Muay Thai, very technical fighter. And something that gets brought up a lot about Luque, and it's important, one of the greatest chins in MMA history.
Oh, he gets cracked in every fight. And if you want to see him get cracked, Brian Barberena fight.
Brian Barberena hits him clean on the chin multiple times. So does Wonderboy. Like, he can get hit. The thing is, he gets back up to his feet. And Wonderboy rocked him a number of times in that fight. But Luque was, I'm going to get hurt. I'm going to get back up. He just has such great recovery and a really good chin. And normally he is quite defensively sound. He will get into firefights just because that's kind of what his style is sort of bred towards, if you will. I'm just kind of worried for Tyron Woodley. I am. This is the first time he's fought a guy who's not going in. I should say, the first time he's fought someone in this version of Tyron Woodley's career, where they're not just going in there to look to take him down. You kind of knew what Usman was going to do if he was going to beat Woodley. He's great at wrestling, he's got a lot of volume, his cardio is insane, and I think he showed all three of those things in that fight. Burns, sort of similar. He's a really good striker, but we know how great his ground game is. The thing that concerned me in the Burns fight was that Woodley had never had a chin issue. He's had one of the better chins really in MMA history up until that point. And I think Gilbert Burns hits hard, don't get me wrong. Burns hurt him multiple times with strikes in that fight, and it's a little concerning because Gilbert Burns takes a lot of his striking from Vicente Luque. They're very close training partners. They are best friends. They train together at Sanford MMA. It's a little concerning when a guy who throws, I'm going to say a lazy left hook in Gilbert Burns, he just throws like sort of a wild overhand left. Luque does that exact same technique, but Luque's been striking his whole life, whereas Gilbert Burns is a lifelong grappler. He's just sort of incorporated the striking as he's been into MMA, where Luque is kind of the opposite. He's got great head and arm chokes on the ground, a really nice darce choke. Go back and watch the first Nico Price fight if you want to see that. Just a really nice setup too after he hurts him with the hands. Luque's career has just always been a really good progression. He always seems like he's getting better. And for Woodley, could the Woodley that fought Wonderboy at UFC 205 in the co-main event come out here and crack Luque with an overhand right and put him down? He could, but my issue is that was almost 4 years ago. That was over 4 years ago, which is wild to think about. And the Tyron Woodley that we've been getting, yes, he's going in there fighting grapplers, but it's not even like he's defending the takedowns, and he's not even letting his hands go. And it's wild because there was a time, well, before he fought Usman, Woodley had the best takedown defense in UFC history, not just in welterweight history, in UFC history. I don't know what the exact stat is now, but I'd imagine it's not the best.
87%, still good.
Still very good. But again, now we kind of know that when he does fight those upper echelon wrestlers, they're able to take him down. I don't think that's going to be an issue in this fight whatsoever. I think if Vicente Luque only trained his wrestling in this training camp, he couldn't take Tyron Woodley down. I would completely get rid of that variable. I think Woodley needs his own takedowns in this fight to win it, and that's just a version of Tyron Woodley we haven't seen in a long time. Because Luque, the only weakness he really has in his game is the fact that his takedown defense is not incredible. It's still good, don't get me wrong. He's still good with, like, the Randy Browns, for instance. He can defend the takedown and force them to become a striker. But Woodley, when he does decide to really go for a nice ground game, he's got the wrestling background. He's got the jiu-jitsu black belt, which is cool that they gave it to him after he submitted Darren Till. But again, we're talking about all these great things that Tyron Woodley has done in the past, and I know MMA isn't very much a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately kind of sport, but it's true. Like, Tyron Woodley, what have you done for me lately? You haven't won a round in your last three fights, and you're 0-14 in rounds.
Tyron Woodley's last three-round fight was back January 31st, 2015, at a catchweight against thick boy Kelvin Gastelum, who missed weight emphatically in that one. 2015! It's been 6 years since he fought a three-round fight. That's amazing. And credit to Tyron Woodley. He's had that many main events, so it's awesome to see. But it just sucks to see where his career's gone, because out of those three losses, the ship has sailed on, you know, probably another title shot. You have to beat Luque, and then you have to work your way up. Look at Wonderboy. He keeps winning. He's not anywhere close to the title shot. He beat Luque, too. Not really all that close. So if you look at it from that perspective, again, Luque is just like that Billy Talent song. There's nothing to lose when no one knows your name.
And I know your name.
A lot of people are getting to know his name. The funny thing about this one, too, for Woodley, he's taken on that level of competition since Strikeforce. Names that you know and recognize. Jay Heron's on that record. If you look at it, though, the strike differential. 2.33 given strikes landed per minute for Woodley to 2.72 taken. It's a negative differential. For Luque, 5.72 to 5.82. It's also negative, but the output's crazy in his fights. You don't love to see all that damage against a lesser level of competition. He wins the majority of the fights that he should win. Stop. He's one of those kind of guys, like a boogeyman that nobody wants to fight. He's like welterweight's Ryan Hall. But for Vicente Luque, it is a very interesting fight. And we talked about the overall odds. You've got Woodley about a 2-1 underdog. You've got Luque at about a minus 250 or thereabouts. Let's look at the Tapology votes, Matt. 1,307 of them, 78% Luque, 48% by decision, 45% by knockout, the 22% that have Woodley, 2/3 of them by decision. So overall, what are you thinking here?
So I do agree with the odds. That's the first thing. It's kind of wild to say that Vicente Luque should be a 2-1 favorite over Tyron Woodley. But if you just look at what both guys have done in the past couple of years, it's hard to say Woodley should be closer with the odds. I'm going to bring up a little bit of a prop in this fight. Vicente Luque's won every single one of his UFC fights by stoppage except for one. And that one fight against Mike Perry, if it had gone on for another minute, the doctor would have stopped it because of how bad his nose was crushed at the end of that from the flying knee of Vicente Luque. So all but one of his fights have come by way of stoppage. I see it going that way again. I really do. If we get that version of Tyron Woodley who puts his back up against the cage, he gets slapped, I will say earlier than like the third round, because that version of Tyron Woodley is going to really get hurt in this fight. If Woodley is a striker in the center of the cage, I don't think he's going to win this fight, but I think it will at least help him avoid some of the big power shots of Luque coming in. But if Woodley just backs up to the cage like we've seen him do 1,000 times, that's kind of what Luque wants you to do anyways. Go back and watch the Nico Price fight. Go back and really watch any of Luque's fights. If he gets you up against the cage, he unloads on you like few fighters do in the UFC, and I do think Luque is going to land a big combo and probably put Woodley away with a shot. It hurts me to say, because again, I remember those years when Tyron Woodley was on top of the world, but now it seems like he's been falling in and out of love. In and out of love with the sport of MMA. So I've got to pick Vicente Luque in this one.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's just a shame because, again, you asked Craig before 2018, before Fight Night picks, Tyron Woodley all day, 100%. I love to watch Tyron Woodley fights. But the guy that we've gotten in the last three, you get backed up by Gilbert Burns, world-class fighter. So's Usman, so's Covington. These are generational talents. And that might sound like I'm really putting them on a pedestal. But again, where the sport is right now, these guys are so good at what they do. And I mean, you put them years ago, they would have been great. They would have been champs.
Oh, last thing for me. Also, Gilbert Burns beat Tyron Woodley. I just mentioned the striking of Luque. They're also best friends and train together. If there's anyone out there who can give you a good game plan to beat Tyron Woodley, it's probably the guy who's already done it.
Be weird in a three-round atmosphere, and Burns better wrestler than Luque, but still, if Woodley wrestles and if Woodley gets on top, the ground and pound's going to be insane. If he decides to strike, could be insane. But both of us going Matt with Vicente Luque to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. We got a great main event coming up. You're not going to want to miss it. You have Stipe Miocic taking on Francis Ngannou. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time banger of a main event. And luckily, I had the opportunity to be there for the first one. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. With me, as always, Matt Allen. You can find him on the socials at MattAllenFNP. And as always, we're going to be talking about this fight all week. You're going to find it on Early Stoppage. You're also going to find it on Fight Night Picks Kicks this Saturday, live 2 hours before the prelims. And as it's a pay-per-view, we're also going to have the Fight Companion as well. So really looking forward to that content. But Matt, getting it back into our main event, we have a rematch where at UFC 220, you had gold all over the place. The co-main event, Daniel Cormier, Volkan Oezdemir. In the main event, you had Miocic and Ngannou won. And the issue in that fight was you saw the meteoric rise of Francis Ngannou, just knocking people out left, right, and center. Absolutely unrivaled power. They're going to tell you about that all week. He has the hardest punching power of any single person alive. What is it that they use? It's like a Ford Escort. It's like a 12-pound sledgehammer all the way down. That's how hard this guy hits. For Stipe in that fight, well, he's got a good wrestling base, and he has great boxing fundamentals, and those are ultimately what won out in that fight. Now, he did absorb some of Ngannou's power, and he ate it like, I don't know, a bagged lunch at a fire hall. He was able to do quite well with that. So, bear all that in mind, and in that fight for Stipe, again, the pressure and the pace he was able to put on and the takedowns ultimately won out. And for a guy there with his friends, sitting up in the nosebleeds with Matt Bissett's family of all people, there were a lot of Bissett fans there, everybody was just so in awe of the fact that Ngannou could shut Stipe's lights out. Even if he was tired, he could do it in the later rounds. And for Stipe, he could just grind out a win. Again, ultimately, Stipe ground out a win, absorbed a little bit of punishment. But you come into this fight, and you look at the career trajectories. For Stipe, fought Cormier a few times. His last time out, picks up a huge win. For Francis, he fights Derek Lewis not that long after. And it was a weird one. And listen, ultimately he lost out one of the most boring fights that you're ever going to see. But after that, he took a different approach to his career. We're going to sports psychologists. We're going to work through these issues. And holy smokes, back again, Francis Ngannou knocking guys out. So for Ngannou, he's added little wrinkles into his game. We've seen, is the takedown defense an issue? Well, nobody really gets to test it because he knocks you out before you get to find out. And for him as well, a lot of sites might still have him listed as MMA Factory. A lot of people might say, oh, well, he still trains with Ciryl Gane. No, sirree, Bob. Doesn't train at MMA Factory anymore. Fernand Lopez and Francis are no more. They are definitely on the outs. Francis has been at Extreme Couture for quite some time, working out a little bit at the PI too. Why not? I mean, free food, free gym.
It's the best version of Francis that we've seen too.
That's the thing. So you have 100% Francis coming into this fight, or we assume. And you have Stipe, who he's battled injuries in the past. We don't really get to hear much about him. And that's a weird thing too. Before the pandemic, Stipe was kind of those guys like, is he a star? Because he's the best heavyweight we've ever seen. But is he a star?
No.
Well, they try and put him into opportunities, and he talks like a guy who's got a bag of marbles in his mouth. And then he's in Modelo commercials, and now the pandemic hit. He's still a firefighter. He's still working his 9-to-5. We haven't really heard much out of Stipe.
Stipe Miocic, just a straight-up good guy by all accounts, so good on him for helping his community in Cleveland. For Stipe, this is such an important fight because I do think he's cemented himself as the greatest heavyweight of all time. I don't think there's much of a pushback on that because a lot of people who thought the greatest heavyweight of all time was Fedor have kind of aged themselves out of the sport. And a lot of people who watch MMA now probably aren't as familiar with what Fedor did back in the day and are more familiar with what Fedor is doing now. I don't know what that face is for because I haven't said anything.
Knocking out Rampage Jackson?
Ooh, Stipe's the greatest heavyweight of all time. And his level of competition really does show that. You lost to DC, who is another one of the greatest fighters of all time. And then you don't only come back and reinvent yourself, you come back and reinvent your body. And that's a really big talking point that I don't think enough people are talking about in this fight. Stipe, after that first DC fight, dropped 11 pounds, I believe it was. And then he did look a lot leaner in the third fight as well. If that's the Stipe who shows up to fight Francis, I think it's the best thing going for him. I actually think the smaller Stipe can be in this fight is going to be the biggest advantage. And a lot of people would think of it as the opposite way. Oh, you're fighting Francis. He's so big. You want to try to match his strength with your strength. Not at all. No matter what Stipe Miocic does, he will never be the pure power puncher that Francis Ngannou is. And there's no problem with that whatsoever because Miocic already has insane pop on his shots. It's not like he's some pillow-fisted heavyweight. But if Stipe focuses more on speed than power, it's going to give him an even bigger advantage. Because if you go back and watch that first fight, Francis does land shots, don't get me wrong. But a lot of the shots that Francis lands are when Stipe is in range trying to land his own shots. And once Stipe kind of realizes that I can't fight this guy like I'm fighting another fighter, I have to fight him like he's a bear. And it's weird to say that because there's a few defensive moments where Stipe doesn't really do what you would expect from an MMA fighter. He's just getting his body out of the way of Francis' shots. And I understand that's a bit of a weird statement to make. But go back. When Francis is throwing those big looping straights, Stipe does a good job of getting his head out of the way and then separating. But it's not in the most traditional sense. It's not like he's just moving his head out of the way, you're missing by a couple inches, and then he's there to counter. He's just making sure he's out of the range of Francis because he realized that, yeah, that first round might suck, and a little bit of the second round might suck too. But Stipe's got, I don't even want to say good heavyweight cardio. Like, Stipe could fight middleweights and probably outlast a lot of them in the fifth round because he does have a great gas tank. He's got a great knowledge of the sport, too. And I don't think fight IQ is something that gets brought up enough when you talk about Stipe because, again, he sounds like he's on SWAT people. If he was out there shooting alligators and I don't really know what they do in that show. I just remember they killed a lot of alligators. They did have subtitles, though, and it was an English-speaking show. Stipe could have those, but his fight IQ is through the roof, and his in-fight adjustments are very important to bring up. And I know what everyone goes back and talks about is the DC fight. Well, let's break that fight down. Round one gets taken down and dominated on the mat. It's basically a 10-8 for DC. Round two, very back and forth. Both guys throwing good strikes, but Stipe is able to defend the takedown. Round three, able to defend more takedowns. Stipe starting to come on a little bit. And when that fourth round, what Craig just showed, when he starts landing that lead hook to the body, you can tell DC's like, oh, I didn't really expect this. And Stipe goes back to the well over and over and over again. And the great thing about body shots is that, yeah, you might not put a guy down with the first one that you throw, but they're going to drop his hands. And they're going to drop his hands a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And stuff like that, you don't see guys fight like Stipe on the prelims, you know? And it's not like on the prelims they're lesser fighters. It's just Stipe is the greatest of all time for a reason. He has the skill set to match. Francis doesn't have the greatest skill set in the world. It's just the truth. And breaking down this fight is a lot similar to breaking down Derek Lewis' fight. How good can Stipe Miocic defend his head until Francis lands on him? Or can Francis land in the first place? And last thing for me, and then I'll let you take off. Go back and watch the Rozenstruik fight with Francis, because just those 20 seconds are all of Ngannou's, it's basically his whole career in one 20-second spurt. He throws massive windmill punches, misses six of them. Jairzinho does everything right, stays on the inside, keeps everything compact, counters, lands a really nice inside leg kick, and you're like, wow, wait, Jairzinho fighting great going backwards. And then Francis lands one left hook, and Jairzinho goes limp. And you're probably like, oh, well, that fight's over, right? But here's the thing. In MMA, if the ref's not right there, you can land a couple clean ones. And Francis lands, like, four of the most disgusting punches up against the cage that you're ever going to see. And I think we're going to see the same version of Francis. If he lands on Stipe, will he put him to sleep? Probably. If Stipe stays really compact and defensively sound, can he win this fight? Yes. But again, Francis Ngannou has that sort of nuclear launch code where if he hits you with one punch, it can be the left hand or the right hand, he's going to put you to sleep.
If you look at Francis Ngannou's overall career, let's just go through the UFC. Beats Luis Enrique, knocks him out. Beats Curtis Blaydes, finishes him. Beats Bojan Mihailovic, finishes him. Beats Freight Train Hamilton, Kimura, just a meathead submission. Beats Andre Arlovski, knocks him out. Knocks out Alistair Overeem, one of the most disgusting uppercuts you've ever seen. Gets a title shot, loses. Fights Derek Lewis, boring. Knocks out Curtis Blaydes again. Disgusting. And it's really weird knockout, too. Okay. Disgusting. Finishes Cain Velasquez. Now, does knee give out? I don't think it did. He knocked him out, and it was gross. Finishes JDS, glass cannon. Finishes Jairzinho, Rozenstruik. Not easy to do. Handed Jairzinho his first loss. Now, was Jairzinho coming off a fight against Alistair Overeem where maybe he lost and maybe he won?
I mean, he looked good.
Well, he looked good at the end, so it is what it is. Francis finished him in 20 seconds. You can't talk about it enough. If Mike Tyson's ranting and raving over you, you're probably pretty good. And we've talked about this before. If those icons of the sport know your name, then that's a great thing. Dana White was on Mike Tyson's podcast here in the last couple of weeks. It was a really short episode. It was only like 25 minutes or 31. It was really short. But they brought up Francis Ngannou. It was him and his co-hosts that were like, hey, What about that Ngannou guy with the UFC? Mike knew enough to talk about him. It's just like Joe Rogan a few weeks ago at the last pay-per-view go, Uroš Medic is a guy you need to watch. Before the fight, and I thought, oh boy, this isn't good. If Rogan's talking about this, could be really bad. And Medic goes out there and puts on a clinic, and then they have that back and forth. Ngannou's one of those guys too, and he's lived up to that. I know he's lost his title fight, but he's one of those guys that's must-see TV. And if you're watching now, hey, thanks for still tuning in. It's because this guy. We're great, but it's because of this guy. So for Ngannou, you'd have to expect. If he's going to win, he finishes Stipe. For Stipe, could be another decision. He could grind one out.
Isn't it wild that France is the favorite, too? Again, we've seen this fight play out once before, and it wasn't that competitive. And yes, France has landed shots. I shouldn't say it wasn't that competitive. France did have his moments, don't get me wrong. But just when you look at the scorecards at the end, you're like, Stipe beat the shit out of Francis. But that's not really how the fight went. And for Francis, here's another X factor. You talk about how he doesn't train with Ciryl Gane anymore. He did train a little bit with Teddy Atlas. Now, I'm not exactly sure how long he trained with him, but just training with him for a little bit is probably going to help your boxing, and just having him in sort of your camp will help you out.
What about having Black Cobra Striking Systems Dewey Cooper in the corner?
I don't know if Dewey Cooper helps out as much as Teddy Atlas. I mean, Teddy Atlas helped Povetkin win a heavyweight title. Anyways, I think Francis Ngannou is coming into this fight as a different fighter, and I do like everything that he said leading up to this fight. Before Anthony Pettis fought Alex Moreno, I had to hear him say he became a new fighter. It was something I had in the back of my head. And he did. He actually did a whole interview with Ariel Helwani talking about how the mental side of his game wasn't there, and he's really been working on it. And after he did kind of get his mind right, that's when everything
Eamon
else...
Eamon Zahabi did the exact same thing before he fought Draco Rodriguez. Exactly. It was, I've been reading books on psychology, working with a sports psychologist, and my mentality for this fight is perfect. Sometimes you hear it and it's not overly convincing, but I also do like that.
Oh yeah, and I do think people are now starting to realize that once you kind of get, the more locked in you are, the better you're going to be. Look at The Last Dance. Like, Michael Jordan had to find a reason to want to win his sixth title. So you just look at some random guy on the other bench and be like, I'm going to drop 60 on him tonight. You have to find motivation in different ways. And for Francis, going into that first title fight, well, I've knocked everyone out in a minute. Why is this going to be any different? Then you have that really hard fight. Now we're seeing him starting to defend takedowns, and that's what the really important key is in this fight, where it's not just like Francis Ngannou's going in there and he seems hesitant. He's letting his hands go. He's not as worried about the takedown attempt, and I think that's the best version of Francis. I think Stipe Miocic can beat any single man on this planet in a fist fight. I think when Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury had their dumb two-fight deal, because boxing's stupid even though I like it, they can't say at the end of the night that, oh, this is the baddest man alive, because they're not. If they ever fought Stipe Miocic, that fight would last 30 seconds. He'd take them down and beat the brakes off them. This is a hard fight, though, and I do think this new version of Francis, listen, we have a Francis who hasn't taken any damage since that first Stipe fight. You have Stipe, who's fought another one of the greatest fighters of all time, three times since the first time he fought Francis, and yeah, he beat DC twice, but that second fight is a hard fight, and so is the third fight. It's not like he just ran over DC twice. Like, they were long, hard, drawn-out fights. It would make me happy to see Stipe Miocic win this fight and retire and just kind of go off into the sunset. You've done everything you can do in the sport. You're the greatest heavyweight of all time. They should put where LeBron's banner was in Cleveland and him throwing the chalk. They should take that down. I guess it's probably not there anymore. And they should put up a big banner of Stipe Miocic holding that heavyweight title, because he means a lot to the city of Cleveland, especially in their sports. I just think Francis Ngannou's got it. I think he's in the right mental state. The fact that he hasn't taken damage in a long time is important. And if he can just defend one or two takedowns in this fight, I think he'll be able to get the knockout win.
Matt, if we have a look at Fight Night Picks in the YouTube comments section, or community section rather, this is where it gets interesting. I threw it out there. Who's going to get the win between these two guys? 1,400 total votes, 65% Miocic, 35% Ngannou. And let's go down through some of the comments, Matt. I mean, super fan going with Stipe, Akash Dipathy, saying, honestly, think he's improved a bunch. There's a lot of good comments out here. David S., going with Stipe. There's a lot of people going with him. Vicente the Goat saying Francis by brutal knockout.
That wasn't
70-30 Stiopic. Can't for the life of me figure out why people want Ngannou as champ. Most meat and potatoes fighter on the roster skill-wise. A lot of people saying he doesn't have any skills. He's made his way up to the number one ranked heavyweight to contend for the title against Miocic. If you look at the odds, Francis opened a minus 225 favorite. He's a minus 124 right now. So 101 point change in those odds. Miocic opened plus 190, now at a plus 100. I bet that by the time of the fight, Miocic is probably the favorite in this one. And it gets really tricky. I mean, with the votes, if you go over on Tapology, maybe they have a little bit more. Well, they don't. 1,300, 57% Miocic, 43% Ngannou. Just about all the polls out there are pretty close, so it is a pretty decisive fight.
It is. Now,
Divisive,
there you go. So for the odds on Francis, again, these odds probably are going to be even by the time of the fight. Maybe Stipe slight favorite, maybe Francis slight favorite, but we'll just call him even for the time being. Just here's the thing. Francis can't win any other way by knockout. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Like, I don't think Francis can win a decision against Stipe.
What about by submission?
I don't think he can do that either. His only submission win in the UFC was against Anthony Freight Train Hamilton. Who
win some, you lose some. Freight Train
exactly.
Hamilton.
A guy whose name we only remember because of how poor his UFC ride went. And the way he was able to get that Kimura was he had Hamilton up against the cage, didn't really know what to do, grabbed an arm, and just wrenched on it. It was nice, don't get me wrong. But it wasn't a technical submission as much as just a brute force submission. And last point on submissions, I guess, for both guys. There's a point in their first fight where Stipe has side control. I'm going to call it side control, but it isn't. He's basically standing on his knees, if you will, just punching the ground as Francis lays there. There's nothing holding Francis down. If he wants to get up, he could sit up like The Undertaker. I think Stipe is a good wrestler. I worry about his grappling side a little bit. I think if Francis, again, can defend some takedowns, I think if Francis even has a basic knowledge of get-ups, he should be able to get back up to his feet at some point. Stipe, we saw, go back to the Mark Hunt fight, he does a much better job of kind of breaking down his base over and over again and really just wearing on Mark Hunt. But Mark Hunt's grappling is an absolute zero, whereas Francis Ngannou is at least a 0.5 out of 10. So I do think if Ngannou, again, I need to see some takedown defense. And this is also going to be a weird thing. If Stipe weighs under 145 pounds, I think
145.
Sorry, goodness, then he'll probably be dead. If he weighs under 245, I like his chances more, but I do think Francis is going to win inside the distance. And again, the odds for inside the distance, he's a plus 100. If you're going to bet on Francis at all, there's no reason not to say inside the distance, because I really doubt he's going to outlast the heavyweight who has the best cardio of all time.
So you're going with Cameroon's Francis Ngannou.
Inside the distance.
I have a really tough time with this one, because again, you've seen what happened, but it's been a long time since then. It's been 2 years and 8 months since Stipe fought Cormier for the first time. It's been 3 years and 2 months since these two guys squared off. So for Stipe, the injuries, the layoffs, he's 38. It's not like Ngannou's a young guy. Like, he's 34
for
coming into this one. Almost 35. The miles, again, you lose the decision to Miocic, you lose to Derek Lewis, and then you lose early on in your career. So it's not like, you know, he's taken a ton of damage in his fights. He's the one that's really putting on the damage, Darren Elkins. I have such a hard time with this one. It's such a question mark kicks on a Saturday, but I'm also going with Francis Ngannou. And listen, people are going to be so mad in the comment section. Let me hear it. But listen, I consider Stipe the greatest heavyweight of all time as well. I don't think it's a far-fetched thing to say. I think there's a time and place for Fedor, and Stipe just kind of took over that crown, and that's fine. Listen, titles pass hands, so do GOAT conversations. Look at Kamaru Usman. GSP, Kamaru Usman.
Not even close yet.
See what happens. But, yeah, I'm ultimately going with Cameroon's Francis Ngannou. I think, again, the changes in the game plan, the mindset's a huge deal. And if we're at least talking about it, we've overcome it. I really do like Francis Ngannou in this fight as well. It should be a great fight. We're both going with Ngannou. And if you dislike it, you dislike it. But hey, we did our best to try and preview the fight for you. Maybe you don't like the pick, but maybe you like the analysis. We're really looking forward to this weekend's card. We have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. We also have our fight companion live for UFC 260. We usually start about 5 minutes before the pay-per-view. You can hang out with us, and you can call us donkeys if Stipe Miocic wins. That'll be absolutely fine with me. Hopefully everybody enjoys their week. Enjoy the fights. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks as there changes. Maybe we have Burchak fighting, maybe we have Morales, Young, who knows? Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it.